Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff, episode 201.
201. What happened to episode 200?
We did episode 200 on Monday.
Oh yeah, we did.
So if you missed it, our milestone 200th episode was on Monday. Yeah. A little bonus episode for you. We're making it a two-podcast week just for fun. Because we hadn't talked about Twin Peaks yet.
Yeah, and it would have been a bit absurd to talk about our 10 favorite movies for 4 hours and then try to talk about an episode of Twin Peaks after that.
Yep, so if you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to episode 200. I really enjoyed it.
So did I, yeah. That was a fun podcast.
Fun podcast. We also launched a Patreon with it, which we will talk about in just a moment. Let's give you a quick lowdown on what's going to be on the show today. On the show, we're going to talk a bunch of news, just random odds and ends. We're going to go over some of the games that are coming out in August, just so we have a little roadmap for the month.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Twin Peaks. We're going to hit a couple pieces of stuff. I'm going to see if I can talk spoiler-free about Game of Thrones for like 5 minutes. So we've got all of that. But let's talk some housekeeping, Sean.
Okay, what's going on in our house, Jonathan?
We launched a Patreon.
Yes, we did.
Which I think is pretty cool. It's patreon.com/weeklystuffpodcast. Or you can go to jonathanlack.com and there's a little marker right there. Or to weeklystuffpodcast.com and there's a link on that page. Yeah. So you can, or our Twitters. You can find it if you want to find it. And you should, because we have some fun rewards. I'm not going to go through all of them again right now. But I will say one thing, which is that our first set of rewards, like major rewards, is launching this Friday.
Yeah.
So, and that is the first 5 episodes of our Let's Play game series. If you donate to our Patreon at the Warthog level or above, which is the $10 level, then you will get early access to all our Let's Play videos. And our first series is in Halo Combat Evolved, and it's really fun. We go through it. I've edited 4.5 episodes. You've seen some of the early cuts of some of them.
Yeah.
And I think it's really fun. And I say that as someone who, A, doesn't like listening to my own voice, and B, doesn't actually like Let's Plays all that much.
Mm.
So it's a solid recommendation for me. As unbiased as someone who is in it can be, I think they've turned out well.
Yeah, I definitely agree, because I also have, I cannot listen to our podcast in, for stretches. So it's a good thing that I don't have to ever edit them, because it drives me crazy. But I did, you sent me some of the rough cuts for episode 1 and 2 of the Let's Play, and I watched them all the way through, and it took a second to get used to being who is that fucking asshole who's talking at half the time? Right, that's me! Once I got over that, I do think they're really awesome. I like what we're doing with it. I really like the edits you've been doing. I think people are going to really enjoy it.
I have made so many silly Photoshops.
Yeah.
You've seen some of them. They're really silly. You're going to like these. And there's some serious academic talk as well.
Yes.
But
it's a good blend.
I think they're fun. And what we're going to do, just to fill you in on this, is on Friday, all 5 episodes of the... It's going to be a 10-episode series for Halo, and you're going to get the first 5 on Friday if you're a Patreon. And then on that same day, episode 1 is going to go out to the general public so that they have a little preview of it, so that they can see it. And then if they like it, they can come subscribe to our Patreon. So spread the good word if you like it. But you'll get all 5. So if you like it, you can just keep on watching them. And hopefully if you haven't subscribed to our Patreon and are waiting to see what this content is, watch episode 1 on Friday and see if you like it. And I think you will. And so those 5 episodes will come out. From there, the following Friday is when we're going to start our regular release schedule with the Let's Plays. And that's going to be Mondays and Fridays there will be new episodes.
Yeah.
So we're going to do a Friday and then a Friday. But then from that point on, it will be Mondays and Fridays pretty regularly. And once those first batch of 5 are starting to wrap up is when you will get the second batch of 5 if you're a Patreon, about a week before we get to episode 6 in the public release schedule. But if you want to know what the general schedule for our whole podcast stuff is going to be, and you can see this very clearly on the YouTube channel where everything will be, Monday will be a Let's Play, Wednesday will be the podcast, Friday will be another Let's Play, and then the bonus classic Doctor Who episodes, which we will have episode 0 of for the public coming out soon as a preview episode, that will be on a random day during the month.
Yeah.
But I do think that Monday, Wednesday, Friday upload schedule you guys are going to get into the rhythm of, and I would recommend, if you like these, we're going to release them kind of as a Netflix model where you can just kind of binge the episodes if you want and not have to wait for the normal release if you want to subscribe to our Patreon, so I think that's going to be cool. And we are having to split these up as 5 and 5 right now just because we're at the very beginning of this.
Yeah.
But I do think if we can get a head start, I'd love to be able to, for maybe the second or third game we do this in, get the whole series out to you guys early and then have it dole out to the public.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of fun plans.
Yeah. The Let's Play stuff is really fun. We both have a lot of ideas of other games to do and maybe special other episodes, because right now, sort of the major plan is to do full Let's Plays of games that we both that we know a lot about and can talk a lot about. And so for this first one, obviously, is Halo. Then we're going to do Super Mario 64 is going to be the next one. But I think that we have ideas for other ones that don't necessarily have to be full,
yeah,
like playthroughs of like a story mode of a game.
Yeah, between seasons, basically, of our Let's Plays, like series we do, we're going to have one-off videos. And I have an idea for one. You have an idea for one. We're going to have a lot of fun with these. We might even bring some other people in on some of these. I think it's going to be a blast. So I would urge you to subscribe to our Patreon and see some of the stuff there. I've got one post up right now. There's a little thank you message. And yeah, so...
And don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel, obviously, because that's the easiest way to just stay on top of those videos.
Yep, yeah, the YouTube channel will have, like, everything we produce on there. Of course, the podcast feed will continue to have the podcast, of course. And the other thing I will say, from episode 199 onwards on YouTube, if you want to listen to this podcast with slightly better audio quality, I do make the YouTube videos for recent episodes with lossless audio. In the podcast feed, I don't do that because I don't want you guys to get a 2 gig download.
Right.
But on YouTube, it doesn't matter.
Uh-huh.
So you guys get slightly better audio there if you want to listen there. So yeah, I think it'll be cool. And I'm just excited about everything we're making right now. And I think you guys are going to like what we have in store. So I'm really excited for Friday when we start doling this stuff out.
Yeah.
All right. So you want to talk some stuff?
Let's talk about some stuff, Jonathan.
Well, I've been playing Nier Automata, and you've been playing Nier Automata.
I have. I am still playing Nier, and there are lots of good reasons for that that we can't talk about yet. But it is just like, I love that game, and when I went through the first time, I did not do all the side quest stuff necessarily. So now I'm doing that like completionist kind of playthrough, and I'm really enjoying that.
Yep. I have been kind of in the video editing cave, so I haven't had a ton of time to get started with my playthrough of Nier, but after you talked about it last time, I did go home and buy the game, and I have played about 4 hours of it, and it's very good. I don't have a lot to say about it yet, in part because with every step forward I take in that game, you get more of a sense of, I've seen nothing in this game yet.
Yeah.
Like, even if I didn't have you talking about it, I'd be like, this is so constantly introducing things and zaniness, but I am liking it a lot. The thing that strikes me the most about it, honestly, is the music, which I fucking love.
It's so good.
It does. Not enough games have songs with lyrics. Persona does it. Sonic did it for a while, to varying degrees of success, but I do always like that about Sonic.
But they were
games.
Always charming, even always when charming. The songs maybe weren't that good.
Yeah, the Sonic R soundtrack is still a classic.
Yes, it
still
is.
Still listen to it. And I like that Nier does it, and Nier has a lot of variety in its music, but I also am enjoying the combat and the general zaniness of that. It reminds me a lot of Final Fantasy XV.
Sure.
And kind of the splashiness of it.
I can definitely
so
see
I
that.
Like that. But no, it's a really cool, interesting game. And it's also, I should just say, it is the latest in a line of Japanese RPGs this year that have used basically the same small pool of actors for their dub, where like the guy who plays 9S, your like male companion in Nier, he also is the main voice Alm in Fire Emblem Echoes. He's the main male character T in Puyo Puyo Tetris, and I think he's done background characters in Persona. And then like there's just like Morgana from Persona 5 is the woman in your ear in Nier. Right. And it's just all this crossover. Like those four games I've played this year all have this same kind of small pool of voice actors. And luckily they're very good. But it is funny for me of like, I'm hearing Morgana everywhere now.
Yeah, I mean it's been such a heavy year for Japanese video games in so many ways that I think the dub actors are getting a lot of work this year.
Japan is having a renaissance at the moment, I think, for video games, which definitely is cool. But let's see. I want to talk about Game of Thrones for a moment.
Okay, what's going on in the world of the Game of the Thrones?
And I should say, you don't watch Game of Thrones.
No.
Which is why we don't do a weekly like spoiler cast on it.
Yeah.
We could probably get way more listens if we did. So maybe I'll make you watch it for the last season. I don't know.
Who knows?
But we'll find out.
I'll have to catch up.
Yeah. But Game of Thrones is on again. Of course, we've had 3 episodes this season. And I've been thinking about it so much, so I did want to talk about it a little bit in totally spoiler-free terms. So if you haven't seen the new season yet, you probably don't watch the show, like, let's be honest, because I think Game of Thrones fans don't, like, wait around on this show, because you can't, because, like, people just tweet out, like, the image of the person who died this week, and be like, it was crazy when X died. It's like, I think most people watch Game of Thrones live, that's still a dick move.
Yeah.
You know? But I've been enjoying, it's an interesting season, and it's a phenomena that I kind of wanted to talk about because it weirdly overlaps with things like anime kind of things we talk about, which is they're so far past where the source material is.
Okay, good.
Like, because George R. R. Martin has 5 books.
Right.
And they basically finished adapting what they were going to adapt from those 5 books in season 5. And so season 6 was off the books. Season 7 is further off the books. Apparently they're working from George R. R. Martin's outlines, which he did give to the producers at HBO. And I wonder if he regrets that at all, because he still hasn't produced another book, and that probably makes him sad. But it is a weird
thing. Or maybe he just gave them bullshit outlines that's like true. All going to end with like all the characters who died magically coming to life through the power of love, and they all hold hands and sing a song, and that's how Game of Thrones ends, because that would be great.
But Game of Thrones is doing an interesting thing where they're kind of doing a split final season, almost like Breaking Bad or Mad Men did, although not in... They're calling them separate seasons. But we're getting 7 episodes this year and 6 episodes next year, and then it's done. And I've just been so fascinated grappling with that. One, on the level of... Even as much as HBO clearly trusts the people making this show, and they've made them a lot of money, I see why. It is a little weird that you would let Game of Thrones make fewer than its normal 10 episodes, just on the level of, like, no, we've let you make this show, make 10 fucking episodes. Uh-huh. But also, like, even though season 6 clearly felt like they were building to getting into the final stretch, 13 episodes is all we had left at the start of the season. Now we're into, we only have 10 episodes of Game of Thrones left, period. And that's a weird thing to be looking at. And it still does not feel like... It still feels like there's more story than those 10 episodes could kind of possibly contain.
Right.
And I felt that going into the season, but we've had 3 episodes now. And it's an interesting thing for me, because I think the 3 episodes we've had have been really, really good and in a lot of ways outstanding, in that they have been very fast-paced, but I think... To me, it's not so much the pace, but that every scene has kind of been a hit. There have been little things here and there I haven't liked, but Game of Thrones has always sort of been a show that you watch it and you like 90% of it, but then they'll cut to the one storyline that's like, you have to tune out for those 5 minutes. For me, that was always the Ramsay Bolton stuff from seasons 3 through 6, where they took a character who's in like 2 chapters of book 5 and made him a main character and the worst character in the history of that or pretty much any other show. Huh. And that was a problem. But you ignore that, and then you watch the rest of the show, right?
Right.
I do think this season of Game of Thrones has not had that problem at all. I've pretty much enjoyed every scene. It feels like every scene has advanced the plot in one way or another. It's advanced the characters in one way or another. Every moment of these 3 episodes has had meat, and that's a really impressive thing. It's even been interesting because it's airing the same night as Twin Peaks.
Right.
To compare it, because Game of Thrones has always, not always, but at different periods has had the problem where episodes don't so much feel like episodes, they feel like assemblages of scenes. I think in certain seasons they've done better at that, certain seasons they've done worse. Season 7 they've done an outstanding job in the same way Twin Peaks does of cutting with intent. So if you go from like one set of characters to another, there's a very clear thing within the end of one scene and the beginning of the next that sends us from one place to the next.
Right.
And you know, ways they edit and ways I think they thematize episodes across a lot of geography and time, and I really enjoyed that. That to me feels like a tighter sense of writing and editing and production, and that's really cool. Because I think even if we had been watching it last season, which was a really good season of Game of Thrones, I would feel like it was suffering a little bit in terms of compared to Twin Peaks. And it does in the general sense of like TV art, but just in terms of how they're editing the show. But I feel like it compares positively. At the same time, so all of that's good, and I think the performances have been as good as ever. Lena Headey needs to get her goddamn Emmy for this show, and it's ridiculous she doesn't have one. I hope she does this year, and she had a fucking crazy scene in this last episode, so, you know, and I'm a Lena Headey hipster, you are too.
Sure, because
she was Sarah Connor on the Sarah Connor Chronicles, and we knew she was awesome before you guys did.
Yeah.
Because none of you watched the Sarah Connor Chronicles, and that's why we didn't get a season 3.
No, and that's why Terminator is the cesspool of a franchise it is today.
Yes, that's... The Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles is the best Terminator sequel, and I'm including Judgment Day in that.
Yes, I agree.
All right. That's an unpopular opinion, but I'll say it.
Yes.
Anyway.
We stand firm.
Yes.
Alien, Terminator.
Yeah.
Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Indeed. If you haven't heard other discussions of that, that sentence won't make any sense. But yeah, so the acting has been great. At the same time, they've accelerated the storytelling on this show to a point where there are things in the continuity you just have to turn your brain off for. So, for instance, one plot line going on this season is that there's a character who's like the king of the Iron Islands, an area on the show, named Euron Greyjoy, who we only met last season, even though he'd been in the books for longer. I think they kind of waited too late to introduce him because he's now a major kind of player on the power structure of the show. And in season 6, I feel fine spoiling season 6.
Sure.
And you don't care.
Cause you don't watch it. No.
Yeah. Anyway, like his niece, who's a bigger character on the show, like she didn't get crowned queen, so she ran off from the Iron Islands with all of their fleet. And he's like, oh shit, we don't have a fleet anymore. Let's start building a fleet. At the beginning of season 7, he has like 1,000 ships, and he apparently can teleport the seas.
Okay.
And so much of the plot of this season has been predicated on this one character having a magical fleet of ships he apparently built in a weekend that can travel from like one side of the continent to the other in like the snap of fingers. And it's just one thing that Game of Thrones has really never had a problem. Some people have accused the show of being too slow at times with like characters moving from point A to point B. But there does come a point where I like all the storytelling, but some of the point A to B stuff is like a lot of big events that affect the characters I do like is predicated on a character apparently with magical powers. And that's a weird thing. And okay. It does feel like it's part of a larger thing I'm noticing, which is that I think once they got kind of past the source material on Game of Thrones, the TV show, I think Benioff and Weiss, the creators of this show, favor much neater storytelling than George R. R. Martin does. George R. R. Martin intentionally, I think, has kind of messiness in his storytelling, which is part of what makes the book so good, is that, you know, maybe they get to the same points the show does, but they take a much more winding path there, and nothing ever feels quite as easy or neat. And along the way, there are maybe some red herrings and things where the characters go in directions they don't expect to go. And that's where a lot of the meat of the story happens. We're at a point now where I found season 6, not in a bad way, but very predictable in that once they set up what the story of the season was, I'm like, I know where this is going, and I know how it's going to end, and I know how it's going to get there. And it happened kind of the way I expected, but it was very good along the way.
Sure.
Season 7, I'm pretty sure I know exactly where it's going, and it does feel like every character and everything they've set up is there because they know they're going in a certain direction and they know how they want to kind of tie the bow on it. And I think some of the accelerated storytelling and some of those lapses in clear continuity is part of that, of like the overall, it feels like they're kind of reverse engineering from an ending rather than kind of organically writing on their way there. And I think it's an interesting comparison. I'm not someone who's really down on the show at this point or thinking it's, or one of the people saying, oh, it's so much better than the books because they're so, you know, it's so much quicker or something. I'm kind of in the middle in that I do generally regard the books as a superior piece of storytelling, but I do enjoy the show for its own merits. I am just at a point where, especially because we're so far afield from where the books ended for now, and maybe forever, because I don't know if he's ever getting another book out.
Right.
It is an interesting point of comparison. You know what I mean? And it, when I say it overlaps with anime stuff, like this is a weird thing for American television. This kind of shit happens all the time in
yeah,
anime.
Yeah, it's where Japan has come up with like 500 different solutions for this exact problem.
I think the most prominent example of this particular issue being the original Full Metal Alchemist anime.
Sure, yes.
Which had, yeah. They had a couple of volumes of the manga out at the time, and they decided to go full steam ahead with an anime, ran out of manga in about 25 episodes with a lot of filler in there, and then they're like, Portal to Germany. And that's how, if you've seen Full Metal Alchemist, you know what I mean. And then years later, they did Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood, which is the version that sticks basically one-to-one to the manga, because the manga was wrapping up at that point. So it's an interesting thing. Like, Game of Thrones is probably not going to have Game of Thrones Brotherhood in 10 years.
No. Because I think that weird. It would be hard to do that because live-action actors age in ways that yes. voice actors don't.
Indeed. But I do think it's going to be really interesting if George R. R. Martin finishes these books, which is looking less and less likely with every passing day. He gave us an update in 2015 saying he had just missed a deadline on book 6, and it is now 2017, and he said, don't ask me about it, basically. So I don't know if it's ever coming. And that's book 6. He's planning 7. So who knows? But I do think we're going to get to a point where, like, in 10 years, if we have the whole show and all the books, we're going to look at them and say, boy, that was really weird how either the books or show went differently in these directions.
Yeah.
And I do think one of the big things is we're going to see a deviation at some point where the show decided it was going to go with very neat archetypal storytelling where the point A to point B was much clearer and the thematic elements were much cleaner and there wasn't as much clutter. But I think we're also going to look at the books and say a lot of the meat was in that clutter. And there was a point to some of that. And one isn't necessarily better than the other, but I think it's a very interesting case study. So yeah, we're also at that point probably going to have 5 Game of Thrones spinoffs. And we're going to sure, get down yeah. to like The Handmaidens of Westeros. And that's going to be a show that HBO makes.
I mean, eventually it's just they're going to make some sort of like literal Game of Thrones, like an ESPN sport. Like, I mean, yes. You just have to get every single thing. I mean, we already have the Telltale Game of Thrones game.
Yes.
You know, so they're you know, into the multimedia stuff.
I can't wait for Game of Thrones The Next Generation.
Exactly,
they just
yes.
tell the stories about all the kids.
Yes. Or just, you know, when they do a Game of Thrones, like, The Next Generation, but it's actually like a sci-fi spin-off that's set 5,000 years later, and they're all in space, but it's basically the same story.
It'd be fun.
It's actually just Gundam. It's just literally Gundam.
I will say, speaking of anime connections, too, I also think it is entirely possible, and I just want to get this on the record somewhere, that Game of Thrones ends with them, like, fighting a fire god in the same sense of, like, Persona 5 or something,
sure.
or some any anime, pick an anime,
yeah.
ends with them confronting a god. There's a version of Game of Thrones that feels like it's heading in that Lovecraftian direction, and I hope if they are, they steer into it, because I want to see that.
Right.
Because it would be cool.
But probably, that would make me honestly more excited to watch the show.
It could very well happen.
Cool.
But I'm very curious. It's a weird thing, because this show is like coming up on its ending much faster than I think anyone thought. And we'll see if it works or not. These three episodes have been good. We've only got four left this season, which is a bizarre thing. The last time I saw a season of TV this short was Mad Men season 7/7 part 2, which both had 7 episodes. And Mad Men is not a plot-heavy show, so that right. didn't really matter. But Game of Thrones is like, oh, shit, we're like kind of halfway through this thing already, and it just started. So it's an interesting thing. But yeah. Mostly, I just wanted to talk about Game of Thrones here to see what happens to our subscription numbers right. if I put this in the title yes. of the episode.
Just get that SEO just dripping on us.
Because I look at all these other websites, and they're gaming websites ostensibly, and now all they talk about is Game of Thrones, and I'm thinking...
It has game right in the title, Jonathan.
It's gotta be like a like the hit of a drug is that SEO numbers you see out of a Game of Thrones yeah. post, because it's the most inane shit people post about this fucking show.
I mean, I'm really looking forward to next week you sitting down here and just being a changed man, and it's like, you know, we're watching, like, you go, Sean, go in the corner, and you're watching Game of Thrones right now, and I'm just going to talk about Game of Thrones for 3 fucking hours, and I'm going to do this every week until you are done, and then we just do this Game of Thrones podcast.
And then apparently we plate our houses in gold, because that's all I can assume yes. from Polygon.
Sure.
What? Anyway, you want to talk about some news?
What's going on in the news, Jonathan?
All right. Last week on the show, exactly 1 week ago, on episode 199, I talked about how happy I was that I got a Super NES Classic pre-order from Walmart.
I mean, yeah, how's that going for you? That's got to be great, right?
So we recorded that episode on a Tuesday night.
Yes, we did.
The episode went out Wednesday morning. Wednesday afternoon, the emails went out from Walmart saying, we've canceled all SNES pre-orders.
What? Oh, no.
It was an error.
Oh,
on our episode, I was very wary of it, but I yes. said, you know, other people that had theirs canceled, I had not. And that, so it seemed like a pretty typical thing where they oversold or something. But we said, it's probably a 50-50.
Yes, well, I think that is literally what we said.
But it fell, so I think that was a good prediction.
Yeah.
It fell on the wrong side of the 50-50, but that's how it works. So I no longer have a Super NES Classic pre-order. Nobody in North America has a Super NES Classic pre-order. Those fuckers in Australia and Europe have pre-orders because Nintendo of Europe's got their shit together.
Sure, and they have the cooler looking one too.
They do.
Yeah.
But anyway, no Super NES Classic pre-orders from anyone just yet. Although, today, Tuesday, August 1st, Nintendo did put out a statement
saying, they're just fucking with people.
Saying that they will have pre-orders at all the retailers late August, later this month. And they once again made a marketing speak promise of bigger shipments, and that they are going to do their best so everyone can get a Super NES Classic.
They're just fucking with people at this point.
They probably are.
Honestly, it's almost in some ways would be better for Nintendo to just say nothing, because it's going to be a shit show when this thing launches. Everybody knows it's going to be a shit show when this thing launches. They're not going to solve that problem.
If there are pre-orders, as they have promised, and at least there's a statement confirming pre-orders, that is still a better scenario than the NES Classic, which
sure.
didn't even have pre-orders. If you have pre-orders, it is a smoother process than none. That at least we can say. Does that make it a smooth process relative to other things? No. But smoother relative to the NES Classic, which was a clusterfuck.
Yes.
This could be less clusterfucky. I do think it will be a clusterfuck. Who knows? I really would like to get one of these. It is just looking like, it does feel like we're on the deck of the Titanic, and we can see the iceberg, and Nintendo keeps saying, we're developing anti-iceberg technology. We're going to melt the iceberg before we get there.
Right.
And we keep getting closer, and I'm like, I don't think that iceberg's going anywhere.
Yeah.
Maybe we should delay the iceberg until we can get that anti-iceberg technology.
There's like, or maybe we can just chart a different route yes. that doesn't bring us right into the iceberg.
It's a weird thing. You know, and some people have been saying, oh, they can't even keep up with the Nintendo Switch demand. And that is true, although I will say, the Nintendo Switch, this is the next piece on our outline, is Nintendo did announce that the Nintendo Switch has sold 4.7 million units already
yeah.
worldwide. That's an enormous number. Like, remember the Wii U had 12 million roughly total?
Right.
So they've, in 6 months, not even 6 months, almost hit half of the Wii U's lifespan. So the Switch is like a huge unmitigated success. And I actually think when you look at those numbers and you think about it, like, they're probably doing as well as you could expect them to do.
Right.
Given that the Switch is kind of a complex console to manufacture. I think not even their best estimates had it selling this well. So it
makes, but that doesn't... Like, while that all that is true, yes, that does not raise your confidence for them to be able to manufacture. In fact, it lowers your confidence in them being able to manufacture enough mini Super Nintendos or whatever, because they only have so many factories that they can have work for them.
And that's what I was going to say. I actually think the conventional wisdom on them with the Switch is off a little bit. Like, I don't think this is an example of Nintendo having a bad launch. Like,
no, they're trying to make those things as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and I think people forget most console launches, for 6 months at least, have a little bit of trouble meeting demand.
Yeah.
That's just how it works. Even iPhones, not as bad, but, you know, it's not easy to just walk into an Apple store in the first 6 months of an iPhone launch and go get it. You know, right. These things happen. I think they're doing better than Nintendo has done in a long time with supply and demand on the Nintendo Switch. But exactly what you're saying is that at a certain point, there are a limited number of factories Nintendo can have access to, and they're obviously going to be favoring the Nintendo Switch. I just do wonder, like, this little ancillary thing, which is never going to make them the same kind of money, they can promise they're going to make more. And I, you know what? I believe them. They're going to make more.
Yes.
But more than zero is not a lot.
No.
Because I'm still not convinced anyone owns an NES Classic.
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't think they ever went out there.
I really do think if you want a Super NES Classic, your best bet is probably to start a YouTube channel and hope it gets big enough by the end of September that you can get a Nintendo press credential and get them to send you a free one.
Yes.
That is probably easier than the pre-order process will be.
Almost undoubtedly.
Yeah.
I do not, like, because it's something where I would like to have one of these mini Super Nintendos, but I just don't want to fucking deal with it, you know? Like, it's a much more enticing collection of games than the NES Classic, just because I think most 8-bit games, like the original Legend of Zelda, are much harder to go back to than something like Link to the Past. But, again, like if I have to be, like, staying up till midnight every single night, like near the end of August, on Twitter being like, is this the day when the pre-orders go up? Because you need the 5 fucking minutes after the pre-orders go up to have any hope of getting one. Fuck that shit. I'm not, like, scheduling my life around your fucking video game thing.
Yeah, especially...
I'm not 12 anymore.
Especially knowing the one retailer that I would actually like to buy one of these from is Amazon, because it's easy, and they are horrible with Nintendo products.
Right.
Like, if you want to buy something from Amazon Nintendo-related, don't. It's sure, just not going to go well for you. So it's like, you have to go to GameStop or Walmart or something, and then it just gets a little dicey. So anyway, we'll see. I just don't get your hopes too far up. Enjoy your Nintendo Switch if you can find one. Absolutely recommend it. Nintendo's going to support that thing, we know.
Yes.
Because it's making them an insane amount of money. They're back to being Nintendo, probably plating all their toilets in gold. I think they probably took a little of that gold down during the Wii U era.
Sure, yeah.
It's all back up. They
tightened their belts.
Yeah.
Now it's just they're letting it all out.
Yes. Their Scrooge McDuck vault never emptied, but it, like, lost a thin layer on top.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about another Japanese game thing, which is Dragon Quest XI.
Dragon Quest XI.
Launched this week in Japan. Did you see all those pictures of the long lines and stuff?
Yes, yeah.
People love Dragon Quest.
It still has its pull in the Land of the Rising Sun.
It does. And they announced this week that it will be coming to the West in 2018. They are working on a localization. This will be the first one since, I think, Dragon Quest 7, 8, I don't know, like 8 maybe on the PS2.
8 was the PS2. No, 9 had one because 9 was the 3DS one. Right. 10 is an MMORPG, so 10 did not.
Yeah, but I know, I think the last one that was, like, close in release dates was the PS2 one. Sure. The DS one might have had a longer line. Anyway, it's been a while since there was a big console release of a Dragon Quest game over here. And so that's pretty cool. Now, the only system we have it confirmed for is the PS4. It did have a little post on the PlayStation blog. Yeah. So they're going to be all in on this. And hey, if you haven't noticed, JRPGs are big business for the PlayStation right now.
Yeah.
They are having a renaissance around the world. So, which is awesome. So it's going to be on PS4 at least, and that's cool. I would expect we'll get the 3DS version as well. If you haven't heard, Dragon Quest XI is doing something really cool and experimental that I would love to check out, which is there are 3DS and PS4 versions of this game. They're the same script, they're the same mechanics, but they basically have different graphical styles. And in fact, on the 3DS, you can play it like it's a 16-bit, you know, Super NES game.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. That's a really neat idea. So it's got those two over in Japan, and there is a Nintendo Switch port on the way as well. So, you know, conceivably by the time it comes out over here, it could come out for all three consoles. And in fact, it would be kind of cool if Nintendo could get a bundle with, like, the 3DS and the Switch together.
Sure.
But yeah, I would be interested to see what else. Like, I'm sure we'll get the PS4 version no matter what. 3DS probably Switch, we'll see if it's even done by then. But yeah, it would be like the 3DS should probably be a priority just because of the number of 3DSs out there,
right.
Which is still, you know, higher than the PS4 actually. But yeah, Dragon Quest XI, Echoes of an Elusive Age. I love the title of that.
Yes, great subtitle.
Yeah, but I think this is cool. I'm glad it's coming west, and I'm glad we got this confirmation, because it wouldn't have surprised me if we had not heard about this for a while.
Sure, yeah, because Dragon Quest just doesn't have the popularity over here it does in Japan.
Yeah, but I mean, look, if you're a Japanese developer of a game of any kind of scale and you're not getting it localized in some way over here, it's a missed opportunity, especially if your game is on the PS4, because there's clearly a hunger for that right now.
Yes.
If a game is batshit as like Nier Automata could sell what it sold.
Yeah. Or, of course,
Persona 5.
Or, of course, the great Digimon story, Cyber Sleuth, which is, for me, the poster child of weird, small, localized JRPGs over here that just, like, drops into your lap and you're like, this game is fucking amazing.
And sold well enough to get a sequel.
Exactly.
Anyway, this is neat. Speaking of JRPGs, you remember Final Fantasy XV?
Final Fantasy XV, yes, I do, yes.
They have
that game had Miyuki Swashiro in it. She was very good.
I love that game. But it's been having a weird DLC schedule. I'm not getting into that. What I am excited for, this got announced, and it's coming, dropping any day now, the Regalia, the awesome car from Final Fantasy XV.
Yes.
The best part of Final Fantasy XV.
Yeah, the part of car. The best part, yes.
Yeah. It is coming to Forza Horizon 3. If you own an Xbox, and if you own either game, well, you have to have Forza Horizon 3 to play it, obviously.
Sure, yes.
But if you own either one, they will send you the code, and you will get the Regalia to drive around in Forza Horizon 3. And Forza Horizon 3, I didn't even ever really talk about this on the show. Its second DLC pack dropped earlier this year, which was that crazy Hot Wheels one.
Oh, right, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And I just love the idea of driving my Regalia around a fucking Hot Wheels track in Australia.
Yes. Have they said if it's going to fly? Do you have to, like...
I don't think it's going to fly.
If you have, like, clear save data from Final Fantasy XV, do they give you the flying one? That it's, like, impossible to control and just crashes and you all die immediately?
I do not know if it's going to do that, but it will make me go play at least 20 minutes of Forza Horizon 3, which continues to be one of the brightest spots in the Xbox One lineup.
Sure.
And I think this is a fun, goofy thing they're doing.
How the fuck do you think that that happened? Like, what are the circumstances that came about for Square Enix and, like, you know, this Japanese game, Final Fantasy XV, partnering up with an Xbox-exclusive racing game franchise to put their car in their game? How the fuck does that happen?
I don't know, because it's actually, I think, something Forza Horizon 3 hasn't done quite enough of. And it's, look, this is complaining about a stupid thing, but just, they had the Warthog from Halo there on day one, which makes sense. It's an Xbox exclusive.
Yeah.
But I thought, and the Warthog is so great. It's one of the best cars in Forza Horizon 3. I would love if they brought more, like, game vehicles in. Like, that could be a fun... That's a good cross-promotion for everyone. You know, everyone wins out of that. And just start doing that with other games. They really haven't. If they had, this would make more sense. Just like, okay, that's a game that was on Xbox. It was popular. Put them together. Why not?
Yeah.
It doesn't take anyone a lot of work. But it's only kind of the second major video game vehicle they've put into the game. So that does, like, make you look at it and be like, yeah, how did this come about?
Yeah, it's just such a bizarre pairing.
Especially because Forza Horizon 7 is launching soon, and it's the main Forza series, so they don't do as much of the goofy stuff. But it is, all of it's a little bizarre. But hey, I like it. Forza Horizon 3.
Yeah, it's cool. It's a fucking awesome idea.
Yeah, and it's a great game, and it's had a great DLC lineup, and it's been very well supported, and this is a fun way to kind of see it off, because I assume the resources are going to go more towards Forza 7 now that that's coming out. But yeah, I just thought that was neat. You want to talk about a couple pieces of Persona news?
Oh, yeah, yes. Some Persona has dropped,
yes.
Jonathan.
So let's talk about... We'll talk about the concrete bit of news in a minute.
Okay.
Less concrete bit of news is Persona Q2. Seems like it's in the works.
Yes. There have been persistent rumors about Persona Q2 and probably a Persona 5 arena type game. And a, like, Persona 4, the Golden-esque remake of Persona 5 at some point. That the last one is the most, like, spurious of the rumors I've
seen.
I didn't
know about that one.
Yeah.
And I also have trouble imagining what that would be, but...
Yeah.
Persona Q2 has had a domain name registered for a couple months, but, you know, people register domains all the time.
Yeah.
What was significant about this rumor, I discovered this on Reddit, and it, you know, made its way around the interwebs, but the whole thing was that they moved that domain name into their internal registry at Atlas, so it's part of, like, their, you know, web of internet stuff.
Right.
I don't know all the technicals about that, but basically they're moving it inside so that they can probably launch a page for it. And we know there are some Persona announcements coming down the pike later this year. So it would not surprise me if we get a Persona Q2.
Yes. No. And also one of the other persistent rumors that seems fairly likely is there's going to be another Dancing All Night style game. At some point in the future. Yeah.
They just need to get the Persona 3 people in that. Maybe 5 as well, sure, if they're ready for that.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah,
but I want my Lotus Juice.
Exactly. Yes. That's what we need. So it does. It is very clear that there is a lot of stuff going on with Persona-related spinoffs continuing, you know, since like the giant splurge that started in, like, 2012 with Persona 4 Arena. And since then, it's just been, like, a constant, they're fucking... You know,
well,
I mean,
with Persona 5 being the juggernaut it was,
yeah,
I think we're going to get more of these, not less.
Yes, they're milking their franchise, but in a way that I appreciate, because the stuff that they put out is actually really good.
Absolutely. And I like the Persona Q 2 rumor, because I think of all the Persona spinoffs I've looked at, Persona Q is the best. It's so fucking good. And I think the idea of a second one is exciting. It will be interesting to see, like, do they bring in the Persona 5 cast for this one? Is it like a team up with the 4 and 5 cast, or the 3? Do they have all 3? Who knows? Maybe... It depends on when this game is coming out, if they've had enough time to really have people work on this with the Persona 5 cast, but it is an interesting idea. And, you know, my other question with this, when this gets, like, announced or something, is will this be another 3DS game, as Persona Q1 was, or does this move... Does it stay with Nintendo? Does it move to the Switch? You know, who knows?
Yeah, because there hasn't been a new Etrian Odyssey game yet to see where that franchise is going to go.
Etrian Odyssey 5 is coming out in a few months.
Is it on the Switch?
On the 3DS.
Okay, well, that's what I meant. Like, there has not been an Etrian Odyssey game that has not been on the 3DS.
Yeah.
So we don't know where that franchise is going to go in the future.
Yes. Etrian Odyssey is, like, the most DS of all DS games,
because
you really need the two-screen approach. Yeah. And it's great. So I would expect this will be a 3DS game, because we know Atlas really likes that console, and it would totally... Look, it makes sense to support it.
Yeah.
There's, like, 70 million of those things out in the wild, and it's still a viable console. But... I mean, they've launched a new fucking 2DS this week.
Exactly.
You know? But with a Pikmin game nobody liked.
I didn't see those reviews. No one liked it.
I mean, no one hated it. It got better reviews than Federation Force. It wasn't that.
Yeah.
Okay. But I didn't see any, like, you should play this game kind of reviews.
Well, that's unfortunate. I like Pikmin.
I like Pikmin too. I did play the demo and I thought it was okay, but I needed to hear, like, there was going to be more depth to it at some point. And it sounds like that's kind of the downfall, is you kind of get the point in a level or two, and then the rest of the game is just that. But yeah, so I will happily play Persona Q2 on my 3DS. And I do like the idea of the 3DS getting cool, silly games like this every now and then.
Sure.
But yeah, like, I don't know how Etrian Odyssey would translate to the Switch.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to do something with it, but it would be a pretty radical redesign of the series. If Persona Q is still that style of game, it doesn't have to be necessarily, but we'll see.
Yeah, I would assume that it would probably... Like, why call it Persona Q2?
Exactly.
Like, I guess the other thing would be, if it's still an RPG in some form and it's a crossover between two of the games, I guess that's the other thing you could justify calling it a Persona Q2.
Yeah, but most likely 3DS game, direct sequel, I will play the shit out of it. Yes. Persona Q1, again, has a longer play clock on it for me than either Persona 3 or 4. Not Persona 5, which is a fucking juggernaut of a game.
Yes.
But it definitely will 3 or 4, so that was fun.
Well, speaking of Persona 5, Jonathan.
Oh, man. We got the announcement the other day.
Yes, we did.
Persona 5, the animation.
Uh-huh.
The animated series based on Persona 5, coming 2018 from A1 Pictures.
Yes, who they did Persona 4 The Daybreakers, so it makes sense that they are continuing to work. A1 Pictures is a pretty... inconsistent anime studio overall, but they do every once in a while put out a show like Erased, which was from 2 years ago, I think. And so every once in a while they put out a really good one that they put all their weight behind. I very much hope that is the case for Persona 5, the animation.
I think Atlas has pretty good quality control on this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would not necessarily expect anything quite as great as the Persona 3 movies.
Well, I mean, it's not going to have that, like,
right.
Production quality to it, obviously.
Exactly. But I was going to say, I would expect in some ways for it to be maybe, you know, visually more exciting and stuff than Persona 4 the animation, which I also really like.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, you know, it's been several years and generally digital anime has gotten better at that. Yeah. So, no, they put out like a 1-minute teaser video that was very confidence inspiring.
Yeah.
Nothing from the show itself, but it was stylish as hell. And that's all you really need.
Yes. Like if they expanded that out a little bit, I could see that the teaser video they gave, that could have just been like the opening animation for the show. It was a very good teaser.
Yes. I'm really super excited for this.
Me too.
I also realized that if this gets like a Crunchyroll stream or something, we're going to have to like review it week by week, because I think we have a blood oath to do that.
Sure. Yeah. That will be hard, because it's very hard for me to watch anime week by week, because it's, you know, they're 22-minute episodes. It's not... you know, the hour basically that Twin Peaks is.
Maybe we'll do it by arc. Sure. Who knows? But I am so psyched for this. I think it's a good idea to do it as a TV show. Persona 3 has a kind of pace to it that I think fits the movies very well. But Persona 4, and actually especially Persona 5, are so episodic. I think it has to be a TV show.
Like,
and
I wouldn't even mind if they just, like, really, like, bumped out the episode length and just had a bunch of standalone episodes that are just, like, little adventures of them, like, solving another little, like, crime and fixing someone's heart. Because I think the framework and the structure of Persona 5 is actually really conducive to that in a way that Persona 4 wasn't quite.
Yeah, because I like the Persona 4 animation a lot. It's only 26 episodes.
Yeah.
27 with the true ending one? I don't know.
Sure, yeah.
But, like, 26 episodes. Persona 5 seems like that would be a lot to squeeze into 26 episodes. I could see this running for like a good 50, 60 episodes.
Yeah. I think it's either going to be like 25, 26, or it's going to be 50. Like, that's how the blocks would work out.
Yeah, I hope they do a 50 block, because I think I agree with you completely. It would be worth not just retelling the story, but fleshing it out in some areas.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, this probably isn't going to be the exact team that did the Persona 3 movies or anything, but like, they'll probably have learned from those and seen those and maybe gotten some ideas of like, right, there are ways we can enrich this in the cinematic televisual medium that could be really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, hey, Persona 3, the movies were a huge jump from Persona 4, the animation, which was a huge jump from that weird Persona 3 spinoff show that no one watched.
Were you Trinity Soul?
Yeah.
Yeah, I watched the first episode and was like, I don't need to watch this.
Yeah. So, hey, who knows? The sky's the limit. Which is the title of the Persona. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. This is, I feel like, you know, we all knew this was going to come about. It felt destined. But, you know, this is the beauty of destiny to me, is that we... is that it does come about like this.
What, one of the exciting things is we're going to get a canonical name for the Persona 5 protagonist.
Exactly, yes. And they're still teasing us with it, because in the teaser they just call him Hero.
Yes.
In the way they sort of is like the normal way to do it.
What if they do it a pun and his name is H-I-R-O and his name is Hero?
Hiro, yeah. I mean, that's like the main character in Gundam Wing is Hiro Yui. Nice. And he's a bad character. It's a bad name. No, I'm excited. It's going to be traumatizing in some ways, because I'm pretty attached to my name, because I use the same name for the Japanese and the English. It's going to be hard to adjust, as always, because it was a similar process I had to do with Persona 3.
Well, then when we get Persona 5 the Golden in a few years, you can use the new name and get used to it.
Exactly, but it's a traumatizing time for all of us, as we have to get accustomed to seeing that dude and having a new name attached to his face.
Speaking of anime, here's an interesting piece of news I wanted to go over quickly. Sony Pictures Television, they make a lot of TV, obviously, has acquired Funimation, or is in the process of acquiring anime giant Funimation.
Yeah.
Funimation was valued at $150 million in this process. The Sony Pictures TV has bought a 95% stake. Gen Fukunaga, who's been the president of Funimation forever, our entire lifetimes, is still with the company. He'll still be the CEO, but they will be a division of Sony Pictures TV. Funimation was, for years, a division of a company called Navar, which finally dropped them, and Funimation was able to go independent because Navar went in a very different direction. So Funimation has had a couple years in the wild here where they've been independent, but those years, they've also expanded a ton.
Like,
Funimation has always been the anime company in the United States, but they've gotten bigger and bigger. They have their own streaming network. They have that deal with Crunchyroll.
Yeah.
They've been doing movies and having stuff in theaters.
They've been doing like dubs that are like basically episodic dubs at some point. They've gotten so fast at putting them out, which is pretty crazy.
It is pretty crazy, and it's pretty neat. So I actually think this is a cool idea, because I imagine this will only be good for Funimation, because Sony has, if you haven't heard, resources.
Right.
So that could be exciting. But I love what Funimation does, and I hope this means only a brighter future for them, because...
Yeah, I'm curious about what it's going to mean, because Sony also owns Aniplex, which is a pretty major anime studio.
Yes.
So I'm curious to see how, like, if Funimation is going to benefit, like, and their catalog is going to expand because of that and stuff.
I hope so, because actually this is something I wanted to mention. Funimation had actually kind of a falling out with Aniplex, because their big show they had from Aniplex was Fullmetal Alchemist.
Right.
And I think 2 years ago or so, they lost the license. Aniplex refused to renew it. So all Fullmetal Alchemist home video in the United States is just completely out of print. I actually was thinking the other day, I have a Fullmetal Alchemist thing that is worth a ton of money. I'm not going to get rid of it because I love that show. But like, there's some of those DVDs are worth a lot at the moment, especially like late Brotherhood releases, because those were only in print for a little bit. Hopefully that means they can bring that stuff back in print. Fullmetal Alchemist has been on Crunchyroll with the Funimation dub.
Yeah.
which is neat. But you know, you would hope you can expand more than that too. And I would like Funimation to keep making money off their dub of the show too, because they did good work on it. But yeah, Aniplex obviously has a really good library, and I'd like to see more of that. I miss seeing the Aniplex logo before Funimation things. So yeah, I think that'll be big. The question also becomes: there was that Funimation Crunchyroll deal. Will this affect that at all? I hope not. That's clearly, been a pretty beneficial deal for all parties.
Yes, because I've been watching a show they just put up called Mariko and Hachin, which is a really cool show that has been, like, it was pretty well known for a little bit in Japan because it was really famous, and then, like, it was kind of hard to see over here, and then Funimation had the license, and then now finally they have it on Crunchyroll. It's very good. I recommend people watch it.
Yeah, and at some point, I should show you guys my... like in a picture, my Dragon Ball physical media collection, because it's the most ridiculous collection I own of anything. So that I have been buying Funimation DVDs since I was like single digits of age. Like,
right.
So I like this company. I like what they do. They've gone through weird periods, but you know, I think mostly they're a very stand up anime distributor at this point.
I mean, if you are an American fan of anime, like, you owe a debt to Funimation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Invariably. Yeah.
I mean, fuck, the reason we got Shin Godzilla here when we did.
Yes.
Was Funimation, which is not the kind of thing they normally do, but I love the fact that they're expanding into that, and then now they're bought by Sony, makes me hope they do more of the live action stuff too.
Because my DVD or Blu-ray of Shin Godzilla is going to come here tomorrow.
Oh, nice. So, I forgot to pre-order that. I need to get that.
Yes, I'm excited. It's on its way.
I want to watch that movie again. But no, I mean, it's actually one of the hugest gaps right now in access to Japanese media, is it's easy to see anime. Japanese, like, live-action cinema, unless it's a remake of, like, an animated movie, is very hard to see over here. It does not get distributed. Like, Crunchyroll has some anime or live-action drama, like TV shows, but contemporary Japanese film from, like, the 90s to now is hard to get, and I'd like to see maybe, if part of this, maybe if nothing else, Funimation can start doing more live-action film stuff. Because there's no one else in that market. It's an empty market at the moment, so that'd be cool.
Yeah, lots of potential there.
Yeah, this is cool news. I just like that. All right, quickly, before we get on to our Twin Peaks talk, a little bit of an August game preview.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the games we're going to be talking about this month, just really quickly.
Video games are coming back, because it's been a bit of a nice little break here in the summer. Yes.
So this is a feature both for you guys to know what we're going to be talking about, and for us to try to wrap our heads around it.
Uh-huh.
August is not as busy as September and October, but... the game Tacoma is launching today when you're listening to this podcast. If you don't know, Tacoma is the next game from Fulbright, which made Gone Home, which I think is one of the best games of this decade, undoubtedly. And so I'm very excited. I have it preloaded on my Xbox. I actually went to play it today thinking it's a Tuesday, games come out Tuesday, and then it wasn't out yet, and I was kind of disappointed because I had, like, cleared the day to play this for the podcast.
Indie games come out whenever they want, man. That's They're just true. So fucking indie.
Indeed. But I will be playing Tacoma. You probably will play that.
Yeah, I'll play it.
Okay,
yeah.
So we'll talk about that next week.
Yes.
So we will have a Tacoma spoiler cast next week. So if you want to play that and listen along, we will talk that next week. August 15th, we're getting Sonic Mania.
Yeah.
Which I feel like is a game we've been waiting for forever because it's gotten so many delays. But I am psyched we're going to get to play this game.
I'm so fucking excited for that game. It looks so... I've had to stop watching YouTube videos of it because it just looks so good. Mm-hmm. And I realize I'm kind of spoiling it for myself.
Yeah, so Sonic Mania, we are both excited for that. It's coming to everything, including the Nintendo Switch, which I love. So, yeah, we're going to play the shit out of that. Uncharted The Lost Legacy is August 22nd. We will both be playing that.
Yep.
And I'm sure that will not be hard to get through, so we can do a full review of that. Unless they decided suddenly to make a 60-hour Uncharted game, which I don't think they did.
That would be crazy.
That would be crazy. Probably not good. I love Uncharted. No. It shouldn't be 60 hours.
I think it would just utterly destroy them to have to produce that, like, quantity of environmental assets for us to support a 60-hour game. I don't think Naughty Dog could do that.
There's just a ridiculous amount of backtracking. Yeah. That's how they do it. No. And then a game you're excited for, Yakuza Kiwami, at the very end of the month.
Yes.
Yakuza Kiwami, if you don't know, is a remake of the very first Yakuza game.
Yes, so Yakuza 0 came out earlier this year in the States for the first time, which is the prequel. And then so Yakuza Kiwami B is actually based in the Yakuza 0 engine, so it's just continuing on with that stuff. I'm very excited because Yakuza 0 is one of the best games that's come out this year.
Nice. So that is cool. I still have not had time to play Yakuza 0, but one day I'll get to these games, and I'm glad they're coming out here because... it's been hard to play a lot of the recent ones.
Yeah,
so,
no, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so that's August, but that is a cool lineup. I'm excited for these games, and there's enough of a gap there, and Tacoma and Sonic Mania and Uncharted Lost Legacy, none of these are too long that they will distract me too much from playing Nier Automata.
Yeah, luckily it's the games that are coming out in that section are not all fucking 90 hours long, which is what it felt like every big game before that has come out. At least, like, it was the thing of where the perspective thing is, Nier Automata only took me, like, 40 hours. I was like, it's only 40 hours compared to Yakuza and Persona 5 and, like, Zelda, which are all, like, fucking 80 to 100 hour long games.
Yes. We had a spring of very, very long games. Nothing in the fall seeming like it'll be that long, although you could easily spend that much time in Destiny 2 and probably Assassin's Creed Origins, I'm sure you could, you know, spoil yourself on. And who knows? I have no idea with Mario Odyssey.
Yeah.
Like, that game could be a 10-hour game or a 500. I don't know.
Yeah.
How much time do you want to watch, you know, Mario be a mariachi?
Forever.
It totally depends. Yeah.
Forever.
Anyway, we have a lot of games to be excited for, and those are our games for August, so that's going to be our game schedule this month.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, you want to talk some Twin Peaks?
How do we talk about this episode of Twin Peaks, Jonathan?
Well, spoilers from here on out for Twin Peaks Part 12. If you haven't seen it yet, go watch it. It's subtitled Let's Rock, so if you're a Twin Peaks fan, that should just get your heart racing. Yeah.
Sure, yeah. It was a really interesting episode. Like,
Here's where I want to start with this one. This one has had a more divided reaction, and I think for good reason. Like, my initial reaction was like, if you somehow weren't all in on this, I could see this episode of Twin Peaks even more than Crazy Part 8, which at least is, like, so attention-grabbing, really turning you off. Because this is an episode where nothing happens in terms of, like, forward plot momentum. I think a lot of interesting character stuff happens.
Yeah.
I enjoyed every scene. I think there's a lot of good stuff. It is a slow episode at a point where it felt like the plot was accelerating. And I do think because it's sort of devoid of the more exciting, flashy things we've been maybe accustomed to, it's easy to walk away from this one feeling like it's maybe a weaker outlier. But at the same time, I've looked over my notes a couple of times for this episode, and I thought there was some fantastic stuff in this.
No, I think it's a great episode. It's just an episode that the way it's constructed, it's so hard to grasp onto anything, you know? Almost feels like it is like a plate-spinning episode in a normal TV series.
Yeah.
But it's like Twin Peaks' version of that. That is like, it is technically spinning plates, but that also feels like, I mean, the whole point of the show is in some ways spinning plates. And it is like getting into that flow and getting into that mood. But you're right, like, there's no real huge plot momentum, like, going forward. There's no, like, big scene to grab onto that sort of, like, decode the episode.
And I will say, you know, without naming names of critics or anything, because people are entitled to their opinions, but I did see some of the, like, logic of people who have been disliking Twin Peaks start to dismantle a little bit with this one, of being like, because if your complaint was like, oh, the plot is all over the place and isn't moving and stuff, and then you dislike this one, the reason you dislike this one is because you're saying nothing happened, and that's in contrast to other episodes where, whether you, like, identified it or not, things were very clearly happening.
Sure.
I actually think this Twin Peaks has been, the most plot-heavy thing Lynch has ever made, like, other than Dune, which, whatever the hell you make of that. But you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, so I have seen some of the, like, double talk on this a little bit of, like, criticizing it for something that you thought the other episodes were doing but weren't. Like, I've seen a lot of that, because I think some people are just turned off by the general aesthetic of this show, and that's totally fine.
Sure.
This is not for everyone. But then trying to, like, get that down into a deeper, like, and it's because of X, Y, and Z, I think I've seen some traditional critics struggling with that. Although I'm still impressed by just how much of the critical world has embraced this Twin Peaks.
Yeah, it feels like it has inspired a lot of, like, the TV critics I do follow, which is not a lot, but I do, like, I mean, I have a toe in that world, and it was, like, very interesting to see some of them just be like, it was like their writing was in such a way that it's like you could see their face light up when they were writing about Twin Peaks. It's like, I get to write about this crazy thing.
Absolutely. So yeah, so that's just, I wanted to talk about the general reaction. I mean, here's the weirdest thing about this episode, is it's only got about 30 seconds of Kyle MacLachlan.
Yes, but to me, that scene is like the scene of the episode. Like, to me, that was like, that shot and that moment, like, defined the episode for me, and like is what makes the episode make sense in some crazy ways.
So I want to talk about that in just a second.
Yeah.
But I do just want to say, like, I think people forget, like, whether you like Dougie or not, whether you like Dark Cooper, does anyone dislike Dark Cooper? Dark Cooper's great. Anyway, however you like or enjoy Kyle MacLachlan on this show, he is so clearly the rock of the series. You know, he's the only one who gets the starring credit at the end. And I think part of the reason that scene this week is included is because they contractually have to have him in every episode, you know?
Sure.
I, no, I agree there's more thematic stuff to it, but it's also, like, in a cynical way, you can look at that and be like, right, this one almost didn't have the star who has to be in all of them. But I do think if you had a different reaction, not negative, positive, and I definitely had a slightly different reaction to this episode, part of it is that you're a little more adrift in this one because you don't have Kyle MacLachlan there being the guy we kind of return to as the grounding of the series.
Right.
Even if he's not playing the character we knew from the original series.
Or is he?
Or is he? But let's talk about that. Yeah, Kyle MacLachlan has one scene. It comes about midway through the episode, and Sonny Jim takes his father Dougie out and plants him in the yard.
Yeah.
And they're going to play catch. He has put a catcher's mitt on Dougie, which is a great thing. You can tell that Dougie is still in his, like, Asian Cooper attire. He's just got the jacket off.
Yeah.
But he's got the tie and the white shirt. And Sonny Jim, like, winds up and throws the ball, and it just bounces off Dougie's chest. And he looks down, and he looks up, and we cut.
Yeah.
And that's all we get of Kyle MacLachlan. But I agree. I think that scene is kind of a nexus point for the episode.
And it's just something where, because I think there's two ways to talk about it. Like, one, that I think that is what Dougie is doing right now for me, like, puts into perspective and kind of defines everything is kind of like that. It's like a Lazy Sunday episode of Twin Peaks, where it's like, kind of nothing is happening, but that's sort of weirdly the point. But then also just specifically that scene for, like, the Dougie, everything about Dougie, the sort of the Dougie side of the show, that is, to me, like, the most explicit, direct use of, like, American iconography to, like, define Dougie's, like, catatonic state and kind of, like, what it feels like that is saying about American society in some ways. Because we have had him be doing these weird things of existing in society, existing in this job and this family and everything, and moving through life, but having literally no agency whatsoever. He's not doing anything. He's not, like, it's only, like, the handful of times every, like, three episodes he has, like, a vague vision, and he does a small thing like go buy a pie or make some marks on a piece of paper. But generally speaking, he has no agency whatsoever. He's just shuffled around by people throughout his whole life, or lured by coffee into rooms and into meetings. And we have seen that, but it's just been sort of normal, unremarkable things. And then, but having him there playing catch with Sonny Jim and having Sonny Jim having to, like, just put him in place, like, get him to stay there and step away and just throw a baseball at him and have it hit him and fall down. But Sonny Jim does not, like, react in any way to that. Like, it just seems like it's normal to him. He's not like, what's wrong, Dad? Like, you know, it's the same way that everybody has ever responded to Dougie, which is just, like, this sort of placid acceptance of this zombie in their lives, and they don't recognize that he is just a, like, an empty vessel. Having that grafted onto what is maybe, like, the most fucking, like, stereotypical American father-son thing, like that symbol, to me, like, really shone through in a really powerful, impactful way, even though it was only, like, a 10-second scene.
I agree. Like, it actually, I didn't realize Kyle MacLachlan had been absent from the episode until his name came up starring Kyle MacLachlan.
Right.
And I just had to think for a second, like, oh, right, he was only in that one scene, because that one scene to me feels as purposeful and essential as any other Dougie scene.
Yeah.
In exactly what you're saying. The whole thing is riffing on and playing with all these pieces of Americana and masculinity and sort of the role of a white guy like Dougie Jones in the society, and how he moves through it as basically a vegetable at this point. We've called it a satire, we've called it a spoof. The further it goes, I actually think there's more than maybe either of those descriptors to it.
Right.
And this was definitely one of those where, yeah, it's just catch with his son, but you have to have the catch with his son scene at some point. Otherwise, that tapestry of Dougie Jones doesn't feel full.
Yeah.
It's a good scene.
Yeah, it just, like I said, it was there's something about that scene that when the episode was over, in my mind, like, that, like, it's like a big mural or something, and that scene is, like, in the middle and everything. But because, again, it's something that Twin Peaks has done throughout so far this whole season, is having lots of independent storylines that are not necessarily interconnected in individual episodes and cutting between them. And like you said, talking about Game of Thrones earlier, it's about, like, this purposeful editing of cutting to things and there being some sort of, like, thematic or emotional through line to them, not some literal plot or character through line that is connecting all the different pieces.
Yeah. So let's talk about the different pieces.
Okay.
Because I will say, I will contend, in one sense, I think this episode has the weirdest show of weirdest scene of New Twin Peaks.
I agree. Yes, it does. It absolutely does.
Yes.
And that's including everything in episode 8.
I agree. I think it is easier to tell what is going on in episode 8 than in a particular scene in this episode.
Yeah.
And we will get there.
Uh-huh.
But first, let's talk about the weirdest exposition dump in TV history.
Uh-huh.
And that is, we begin at the motel where Albert, Tammy, Gordon, and Diane are staying. Now, Albert, Tammy, and Gordon alone are in this room. They're drinking some wine. Albert says, "Thank God Gordon stocks the plane from his wine cellar." And he yells back, "No, you'll be the one to tell her." And I love that sometimes you can tell what Gordon Cole was like responding to, and sometimes you can't, and this is one of those.
I think it was seller, like sounds like sell her or something like that. So it's that her he latched onto. But yes, there's a larger context there that we are not on that full journey with Mr. Gordon Cole.
No. They give a little toast to the bureau, and then Albert tells Gordon he's going to have to turn up his dial on his little hearing aid because he's going to have to talk quietly because they're going to reveal some secrets to Agent Tammy.
And oh boy, do they reveal some secrets.
But not before Gordon says one of my favorite Gordon lines, which is, "Please speak succinctly and do not make any loud, sharp noises." Which I can also imagine being David Lynch's direction to people on set before calling action.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I loved that. Yes, so Albert, God, Miguel Ferrer is great.
Yeah.
I just want to say, like, before we even get into the scene, because there's some other stuff with Albert and Gordon in this episode.
Yes.
David Lynch should get, like, at least 5 Emmy nods for this show. Because, okay, writing, directing, producing, which would be for best show. He did the sound design.
Yes, the sound design.
Totally deserves that. And I do think Gordon Cole needs an acting nomination because he is really good, especially in this episode, in a comic scene later on. But Miguel Ferrer, I really hope they can find it in their heart to give him a posthumous nomination because he's been so good. And I don't think any of us expected Albert would be one of the most central figures in New Twin Peaks.
Yeah, because he's a really memorable character of old Twin Peaks, but he's not in like that many episodes.
No, he's probably got more screen time on New Twin Peaks already than he ever had in the old one.
Definitely.
And yeah, I love him, and he's phenomenal, and this is one of those scenes. Because here we get Albert explaining to Tammy. I always forget Tammy's last name. Do I have it here anywhere? I always want to call her Tammy Baldwin, and that's not her name. But anyway, I'll see if I can figure it out later. But yes, he explains. I was not able to get this whole speech down, but here are the cliff notes.
Okay,
in the 1970s, the U.S. Air Force had and shut down a project called Project Blue Book. It was a 20-year investigation into UFOs. Because they had no credible evidence, there was a massive cover-up. A few years later, the military and the FBI combined to form a task force to solve unsolved Blue Book cases. They called them Blue Rose cases after one of the unsolved cases they looked at where a woman had a blue rose. All right. Philip Jeffries, the David Bowie character from Fire Walk With Me, who we've heard a lot about in this series, was the head of the Blue Rose Task Force. There were three other agents. We had Albert. We had Chet Desmond, who is the Kiefer Sutherland character, I believe, from Fire Walk With Me. And we had Dale Cooper. Now, Albert is the only one who hasn't disappeared. So we actually learned there that Chet Desmond has gone missing. I like Chet Desmond. Gordon has been reluctant to bring new people in because of this. But as they say, until tonight. Because Agent Preston, there's her name, Preston. Tammy Preston. She has a very impressive resume, as they list. And Tammy Preston is really shocked at this. She's saying, "You're asking me to join the Blue Rose Task Force?" And Gordon looks at her and goes, "Yep." And she smiles. "I'm in." And I really liked that, because Tammy seemed really excited about being part of the Blue Rose Task Force. Because it's a whole thing, if you actually go back to Fire Walk With Me, where Chet Desmond has the same reaction, and then to this stuff, where like the Blue Rose Force is clearly like a legend within the FBI, and everyone wants to be in on it, but it's a very small group of people. So yeah, Sean, we got an explanation for the Blue Rose cases. I never thought we'd get that.
Yeah, like that was it. Again, it's the insane contradiction of this show is somehow it seems so disinterested in giving you any amount of Twin Peaks fan service. It doesn't give a shit. Like, he's literally making fun of you sometimes with the Dougie character for wanting the Twin Peaks fan service. And then at the same time, he just, like, straight to the camera, like, two fucking paragraphs of text that is just exposition explaining, like, one of, like, the core sort of mysteries of Twin Peaks, which is what the fuck was all, like, the Project Blue Book stuff that Major Briggs was a part of, and then, like, the Blue Rose shit from Fire Walk With Me, and how, and, like, who is the Philip Jeffries character. All of that stuff are, like, huge mysteries that if you're deep into the Twin Peaks lore, you've been wondering about for, like, 20 years.
Even giving some context to why the FBI in the world of Twin Peaks is as bizarre as it is.
Yes, so we have a better sort of, like, concrete understanding of them, like, staring at that hell portal in the last episode and not being, like, utterly, like, flabbergasted by it.
What I love most is this is basically the plot of the X-Files.
No, it is absolutely the plot of the X-Files. They just have two more people on the X-Files than they usually did.
Also, like, it's not in a basement. It's at the highest levels of the FBI. Yes. But other than that, yeah, it's unsolved mysteries. In this case, Blue Rose Files versus the literal X-Files. It's fucking crazy.
Yeah, and I just love, it's just thrown out in one scene at like the first scene of the fucking episode, and they just dump it in your lap. It's ridiculous.
It also like opens because they specifically say the words, you know, UFOs, which doesn't have to mean alien stuff. But now I can't put it past them that we're going to see like ET on this show.
Sure, yeah.
You know, like who knows? Like it seems like it's more like metaphysical, interdimensional stuff. But like what I love about all of this is that the closer we get to the end of the show, Lynch is not like backing away from any of the interdimensional stuff. He's not like using it just in the background. It's the text of the show.
Yes.
The main plot is we now have pretty much every set of characters on a collision course with the dimension that is the Red Room.
Yeah.
So we have the FBI agents are going after that, and they found these coordinates. We have the people in the Twin Peaks Sheriff Department, including a major, you know, Sheriff Truman and Bobby and everyone. They are going after the mysterious coordinates from Briggs, and they will probably find this. Evil Cooper is headed to Twin Peaks or somewhere because he wants to find these coordinates. Everyone is on the hunt for this place. Clearly, that is all going to converge. Someone is going to travel interdimensionally in this show more than they already have.
Yes.
Maybe we're going to see someone go through an electrical socket, not out of it.
Again, anything can literally fucking happen in the show.
But it's just like, even after the first, I don't know, 6-7 episodes, part 8 was a game changer. But up to that point, we'd had a lot of that imagery. Lynch had gone there more than he ever did on the original show. But it was still kind of like, this could just be window dressing. This could just be part of the atmosphere. No.
Like you said, it is the literal text of the show now.
Like that scene with the box in episode 1 with the two kids who get killed.
Right.
That seemed like more of an outlier at the beginning. It's not. It's like the prologue. If this were a novel, that's the prologue.
Yeah.
Like where something shocking happens and the rest of the book is explaining it, you know? Getting back to that point. I'm just flabbergasted by this. I love it.
It's amazing. Like, yeah. So one of the most amazing things about the show is that balancing act of somehow explaining everything to you, it feels like, and yet everything is still an utter mystery that you don't have any idea whatever the fuck is going on. I have no idea. And yet he's telling you all of it all the time.
And it's also moving with this sense of confidence
that,
like, we still don't have the whole full picture. It really does feel like, maybe unlike the original series, David Lynch and Mark Frost sat down on this one, having, you know, stewed over this for 25 years, and they knew the mythology, and they knew the story, and they're executing on it. They're doing it in their own goddamn time.
Yes.
But they're executing on it.
Yes. And it's crazy. You definitely have a sense that they went into this with an endgame in mind.
Yeah. So, more things about this scene. I just want to say again, Tammy Preston, I think, is a great character, and I love her in this scene. Like, there's this great shot that holds on Tammy as she takes everything in, right after she kind of takes a drink of the wine, and it's just like, it's a really fun little scene.
Yeah.
I like Tammy. But then we see Diane is on her way, and Diane enters the scene through a red velvet curtain that looks, for all intents, exactly like the Red Room.
Yes.
And I like to imagine that maybe Gordon Cole has been there and we don't know, and he just likes to set up his hotel rooms like that.
Sure, why not?
But who knows? She walks in, smoking through the red velvet curtain. Albert offers Diane a drink. She likes it on the rocks, because of course she does.
Yeah.
This leads to a great exchange where she says, "I like it on the rocks." And he says, "Well, you're in luck. The Dakotas are still in the Ice Age." That's a wonderful piece of writing.
Yes, yeah.
All right. So they want to temporarily deputize Diane because she knows about the Blue Rose cases through her work with Agent Cooper. And she says, "Well, what's in it for me?" Albert says, "Some cash, not much. Maybe the satisfaction of learning what happened to your friend Cooper." She hesitates. She puts out her cigarette. The, like, mysterious Angelo Badalamenti music is rising. And she just raises two fingers mysteriously and says, Let's rock. So...
yes.
Is Diane possessed by, like, the little man from the other place?
I don't know.
Because there is totally a reading of that scene where that's what's happening.
It's a weird, like, Diane's character is still very much a mystery to us at this point.
I mean, with all the stuff going on with Evil Cooper and Dougie and bodies not necessarily representing the person inside and, like, Candy, the girl who is going crazy and all that, like... is that Diane? Like, it's a legitimate question. Like, did Cooper basically take her soul out at some point? And is she stuck in a Red Room dimension somewhere? There's so many possibilities to that. And this is definitely one of those scenes where it's like, yeah, I don't know if this is really the same Diane Cooper was talking to on his tape recorder back in the day.
Yes, it's hard to know.
It's great.
Because there's a whole other side of the scene where you know, like, they tell her they're deputizing her because they think they tell her you can help with the Blue Rose cases because you knew about it. But we all know that actually it's just because they want to keep tabs on her.
Yes.
Because they know that she is in communique with the evil Coop.
Indeed. But yeah, I love Diane. I love...
Yes.
I really thought Laura Dern was going to be in like one or two episodes when she showed up. She's one of the main characters.
Exactly, yeah.
Same with Naomi Watts. It's like these great Lynch veterans coming in, and clearly they love working with Lynch because they didn't come for like a week. They came for months.
Yeah, they're on the whole show.
Yeah, it's great. All right, we have a cut then to Twin Peaks, the foothills of Twin Peaks. Seems like it might be a dark and mysterious scene until Mr. Jerry Horn runs out of the trees into a field. His adventure continues. He trips and falls, gets back up, keeps running, and that's all we get of Jerry Horn.
Yeah. I'm excited for when Twin Peaks the Return is over for someone to just edit together all the footage of him from all the different episodes. Because I feel like we like cut to him at least once every other episode for like 2 minutes or something. He's have another wacky, strange adventure like his foot talking to him.
Well, I love that he's clearly been on like some kind of pot-fueled quest.
Yeah.
Vision journey for a couple of days here. That's the thing. Time is pretty compressed on this show. So it's really only been around a week so far from the beginning of the show. But, like, so this hasn't been a huge amount of time for him. But because we keep going back to Jerry Horn, I imagine in some way he is going to intersect with the main action of this at some point. And I'm so excited to see what that is. And my working theory is that whenever Sheriff Truman and Bobby and Hawk are going out to find the place Major Briggs described, Jerry is going to, like, run through the scene and get trapped in the hell portal.
Yes, he's going to already be there or something.
Yes.
Just, like, there high waiting. Mm-hmm.
It really does feel like this is a piece on the chessboard, and it's moving slowly where it needs to get, but along the way, it's really fucking entertaining.
What if he turns into the fourth dirty bearded man? Because he's already a pretty dirty bearded man. He just needs to get a bit more just, like, gunk on his face.
Man, I have, I would not put it past them.
Yeah.
All right. Next, I want to talk about what, to me, is in some ways the standout scene of the episode, which is the grocery store scene
with
Mrs. Palmer, Sarah Palmer, the mother of Laura Palmer, who...
We have not seen since, like, episode 2 or something.
It's no, we've seen time. A couple of brief glimpses of her, and clearly she is, like, an alcoholic and depressed and all the things you might expect of a woman who went through what she went through.
Yes, like, the last time I remember, like, it was very notable. She was just, like, in her room drunk watching Animal Planet and, like, watching lions hunt a bison or something like that in her room.
Yeah, that was in, I think, episode 2 of this.
It's a very ominous scene.
Very ominous. It's interesting because this episode starts to deal with, like, the fallout on Sarah Palmer's life. Because, remember, she lost her whole family.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing that the original Twin Peaks, it's one of the biggest balls they drop, I think, after Leland dies, is we never really go back to Sarah Palmer. And it's like... That would be an interesting direction, is the emotional fallout on this woman who lost her daughter, who lost her niece, Maddie Palmer, and then found out her husband did all of it, was molesting her daughter, and then died.
Yeah.
Like, Sarah Palmer would be a very broken person, very understandably. And the thing is, Grace Zabriskie is a better actress, maybe not better, but like an actress of more range, I think, than original Twin Peaks let her show off, where she's mostly just kind of the grieving mother.
Right.
For instance... you have not seen Inland Empire, right?
No.
Okay, Inland Empire has a scene with Grace Zabriskie that is like a 5-minute close-up on her with a crappy digital camera, because that's every shot in Inland Empire, and it is fascinating and terrifying and hilarious, and I love it. And I watched that, and I was like, I knew that because I saw the name in the credits, and I'm like, that's the woman from Twin Peaks, but I barely recognized her because it's such a different performance. That's the actress who David Lynch brought back for this.
Yes, yeah.
And... I love that we got a spotlight on her here because I think she is stunningly good in this scene.
Yeah, I agree.
So we have Sarah Palmer shopping. She has a cart with 2 giant bottles of Bloody Mary mix. She's in the alcohol aisle and she gets 3 big things of vodka or something. And then she buys a carton of Salem's. And while she's doing this, she's looking at the beef jerky behind the clerk.
Technically, it was turkey jerky.
Yes, she's very disturbed by them. And she said, I'm just going to go through the exchange because it's amazing. I don't remember seeing those beef jerky there before. They're new. What type is it? It's turkey, not beef. Is it smoked? I think so. It's the same as beef jerky, except made from turkey. Were you here when they first came? Yes, they bought it a couple weeks ago. it really seems different. And men are coming. I'm not sure I know. I'm trying to tell you that you don't, that you have to watch out. Things can happen. Happened to me. Something happened to me. And then she starts shouting, I don't feel good.
Yeah.
And she has a whole meltdown and freaks out and leaves the store.
Yes.
With some great dissonant Angela Badalamenti playing.
But then after she leaves the store, you stay in the store for a second with the two clerks. So it's just like,
yes,
this like young woman that is the one that was sort of serving her at the cash register. And then this other guy that looks like he's like 12 years old or something, like the youngest looking person that could possibly be at a cash register. And he says like, I know where she lives. I can deliver it to her.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
It's a strange moment where you just sort of like sit with the cash register people for a second.
And also an interesting reminder, the generational thing.
Yeah.
Those kids don't know what happened to Sarah Palmer.
No, yeah, not at all.
I assume all the older people in town treat her with sensitivity. They have no idea why she is the way she is.
Yeah, because they're like 8 years younger than us. So
right.
They would have been born like 2000, 2001 probably.
So that was an interesting little generational look. But going back to the scene itself, I think it's an amazing scene. The whole,
yeah,
like, focus on the beef jerky. I read the dialogue because it is a... It's almost like a weird beat poetry version of dialogue when you read it out because it's fascinating.
Yeah.
But, like, when you actually listen to it, you don't want to laugh at it. Like, there
no.
is this interesting no. depth to it that, like, she has this... She's freaked out by the beef jerky or the turkey jerky. Of course, it's signaling something else inside her. But the way she has this meltdown at the smallest thing sort of changing in what is probably, we guess, a routine for her... You know, I mean, she spent, it says on the cash register, she's buying $133 worth of alcohol.
Right, yeah.
And probably does it every week or two, you know. It's a really interesting, powerful scene. And Grace Zabriskie has, I think, this really interesting quality where when she plays a freakout, it doesn't feel like any other actor playing a freakout. It really does feel like someone who is in some kind of pain we cannot fathom.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing. And she brings that to Inland Empire as well in her brief scene, but there's no context for that. Here we do know the character and the context of her life. And it's a fascinating sequence.
Yeah, and it feels really... Because I've worked cash registers before in my life and for part-time jobs, and it feels very authentic to that kind of experience where there is someone who has come in that has some sort of issue and, you know, clearly needs help in some way and is having some sort of strange breakdown, but there's no way you can help them and there's nothing you can... There's no way to, like, bridge this gap between you and them, and they just freak out at something that is completely meaningless, like the turkey jerky. And it's something that, like you say, like, it is comical on one hand because of how extreme it is, but it's also, like, really heart-wrenching because we know who she is, if you've seen the original Twin Peaks, and we know what that history is and why she's in as much pain as she is, which is not an experience that you normally get with those people in life.
Indeed. So... There is a follow-up scene,
yeah,
where Hawk goes to Sarah Palmer's house. And it's an interesting scene because at first, you know, you don't necessarily know exactly where he's going, but Laura Palmer's theme is under all of it, which I think clues you in. And when he's there, he's looking through the window and there's the fan spinning ominously, which is a very Twin Peaks image from,
yeah,
the original show. One of the most overt callbacks to original Twin Peaks. Finally, Sarah answers the door. She seems very drunk. Hawk wants to ask her about some of these old cases that are coming up. She realizes he's probably here actually about the grocery store. And Hawk, who seems like at this point he's like the nicest guy in town,
uh-huh,
and clearly cares about everybody and kind of, I think, carries those scars of 25 years ago in a way other people don't, in that he just wants to help other people through it.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, the way we see him dealing with the log lady or with, you know, Bobby in scenes. Like, I love Hawk. He's,
yeah,
a very caring guy.
You definitely get the sense in this scene that he has done this a lot with Sarah.
Yes, I think that's a great way to put it. Because he says, you know, people were worried about you is his main point. And she just says, I don't know what came over me. And she says it like very coldly, like she's also scripting it, like she knows that this is going to happen every time she has a freak out. There's this sound in the background and Hawk asks if someone is there. And she sort of like refuses to answer, you know?
Yeah.
In some ways, she seems almost possessed, but I don't think that's necessarily the point of this scene. I think there's just a general darkness going on, you know?
Yeah, but there is like that weird lingering question of what the fuck was that noise? I think is the thing she says, it was something in the kitchen,
yeah,
instead of like somebody, and it's like that. It's a very strange moment, and then Hawk does not press her at all.
No, I think he knows how this works. You know, he says if you need help of any kind, he says pointedly, give a call. He seems very genuine, but Sarah does not seem responsive in any really any way.
Yeah, and you don't get any like perspective into the house at all. Like, the camera is all basically from Hawk's point of view.
Yeah. So when I talk about like scenes in this episode that, you know, I kind of doubt the Sarah Palmer stuff is going to have a huge tie into the main plot of the story, and I'm okay with it. Mind, who knows? But I just kind of doubt it. But I think these scenes are very valuable, and I think I think they expand the emotional tapestry of the show in ways that are important.
Yeah, because that's what I feel like the show is about in so many ways. Is it's like you have the main plot stuff and all that stuff is great, but it is about building this larger, like you say, tapestry is a good word for it, of all these other events that give a certain mood, and we have been seeing that more and more, I think, the deeper we get into the show, of stuff like last episode where the gunshot goes off and fires into the bar, but it does not, but it's not from anything that is related to the plot. It's just a random circumstance, and you just happen to be with some of the main characters when it happened. It's like that sort of larger sort of tone and feeling is what the show is about, not just the specifics of investigating these mysteries.
Yeah. Speaking of weird non sequitur scenes, there's a sequence with Harry Dean Stanton, the trailer park guy, Carl.
Yeah.
And Carl comes out and sees there's this guy walking with a cane through the trailer park. And Carl knows this guy, seems like he's a tenant, comes up and asks if this man has been selling his blood, and points out that this guy's maybe been doing a lot of work and not getting paid for it. Carl gives him $50 for the work and also says you don't have to pay any rent. So he clearly is taking pity on this guy, knowing he's maybe being kind of beat up by life. And then he has this great line where he says, next time you're thinking about selling your blood, come talk to me. I don't like people selling their blood to eat. It's true the hospital medical people need more blood, but you've given enough already. Keep your blood, Crystal. I don't know what his name was. It sounded, the only word I could make out there was Crystal. I don't know what it was actually.
Sure.
Yeah. So, but I love this whole speech about, like, keep your blood. And my one note here was, that was Lynchian, which it is. But also, like, not a funny scene, this. Also, like, kind of a sweet scene.
Yeah, I mean, it is, it's like, especially juxtaposed with the Sarah Palmer stuff, like, it has a warmth and humanity to it. That is, like, I feel like it's something that the Harry Dean Stanton character, now he's been around for long enough in the show, you get the sense of, like, he's just like this really good guy who's kind of down on his life because he runs a fucking like trailer park and has been running with trailer parks since Fire Walk With Me. It's just a new trailer park. But like he's like kind of weirdly the nicest character in the show. Because I mean, we got introduced to him in the scene where the kid gets run over and he's the only person who goes and comforts the mom.
Yeah, it does seem like Carl kind of cares about the people in his orbit, whoever they are. And I like it. I, you know, who knows where Carl is kind of going, what role he will have in, I can only call it the end game. There's only 6 hours left.
Right.
But, like, yeah, I mean, Carl is clearly being built up as a character, and we are seeing his role in things is generally being a nice guy.
Yeah.
So I like that. Look, any excuse to watch Harry Dean Stanton do his thing. He's very good in this.
I don't like it when people sell their blood for food.
Love it. It's just, it's the good words to live by.
Yeah.
You know, people should not have to sell their blood for food.
No.
Yeah. In fact, the very concept of selling your blood is a fucked up one.
Sure, yeah.
Indeed. Donating blood is good. People should not be driven to sell it. I agree with Carl. That is not a controversial opinion to take, hopefully. Yeah. Anyway, in the middle of this, we have the Dougie scene with Sonny Jim. And we also have a scene at the hospital where we see Miriam, the woman Richard tried to kill, and she's still alive, which sets up a later scene. We also see, there's all these scenes being set up. There's also a cut to Diane at the bar. She's drinking a martini. She gets this text that just says Las Vegas. And then for some reason, in all caps, she tweets or texts back, they haven't asked yet.
Yeah.
I don't know why Diane texts in all caps.
Because it's ominous.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Anyway, but all of this leads to one of the another big centerpiece scene of the episode, which is in Benjamin Horne's office.
Yeah.
And Sheriff Truman comes in. And he says, there's no easy way to say this, Ben. Your grandson, Richard, was the one who ran over and killed that little boy. And Ben Horne is very sad about this, as any grandfather would be, hopefully. And he says, and it looks like he tried to kill the only witness who saw him do it, Miriam Sullivan, nursery school teacher. I like how Miriam is like the nicest person in the world.
Yeah. You know? Like, we didn't know much about her before. And then you hear that, you're like, oh, fucking Richard Horne, you piece of shit.
I know. No, well,
fucking
nursery school
Dick
teacher.
Horn.
We saw her, the one scene before she like saw the murder happen is she's at the Double R Diner, like being the life of the party and being a, just everyone loves her at the diner. So like clearly, yeah, Miriam is a really, Richard didn't like kill some random like douchebag.
Yeah.
He like really hurt an honestly nice woman.
He's a pillar of the community.
Not that there's ever any excuse for doing what he did.
No.
But yeah, Miriam, I like that they are consciously like, no, Miriam was a really good person.
Yeah.
And she's in the intensive care unit. She has no insurance, needs health care, so Ben agrees to take care of her hospital bills, which, you know, nice thing Benjamin Horne is doing.
Yeah.
He explains that Richard, that boy, has never been right. He's always had problems. There's this interesting thing where he talks about how Harry Truman, the other Truman brother, Michael Aunt Keen, who is not in this version of the show, had a number of run-ins with Richard in the past, but it seems like every time Richard has done something bad, he's gotten worse and worse and worse. So this has been an ongoing thing in the town. And then this scene transitions into a very warm conversation between the two of them about Harry Truman. And, you know, Ben wants to know how Harry is doing, says he's hanging in there, all that stuff. And then there's this interesting part where, you know, Ben gets the key out that he got, the Agent Cooper key, and he's reminded about it and says, you know, we wanted to give this to Harry, might be a nice little memento. And Frank Truman, you know, the Robert Forster character, clearly finds this interesting. He doesn't really let anything on beyond saying that, you know, we're opening up an old case involving Agent Cooper. But other than that, it really does feel like Truman, his detective senses are tingling.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah.
Like, he knows something's up with this. But where this scene goes ultimately, I love, is Truman leaves.
Yeah.
And then Beverly comes in. And Ben has this little monologue about how Richard killed that little boy. And, you know, Ben is so torn up about this. And he starts talking and says, Richard never had a father. I remember writing, my father got me this old Schwinn secondhand. He painted it green, got a new seat for it, two-tone green, kind of a lime green and a deep forest green. Fat tires. Oh, it was so hard to ride. But I loved that bike. I'd ride with my friends. And then he kind of trails off. Richard Boehmer is so good in this.
Yes, yeah.
Like, this is a showcase for a lot of actors. This episode is a showcase for a lot of actors who maybe have not gotten the big showcases. And Ben Horn has had a couple of scenes. But that whole monologue about his childhood and all the stuff where he's talking about Harry Truman and this whole sense that, you know, Ben Horn was not a very nice guy in the original Twin Peaks, but, like, over the last 25 years, he has clearly mellowed out.
Well, I mean, you forget, his last plot arc dealt with him reenacting the Civil War, and then coming out of that, he was reborn as a more moral version of himself. And that was, like, the last time we kind of left him was him trying to sort of right the wrongs of his past.
That's compulsively. True.
And I feel like his character here is, like, kind of, like, keeping that in mind. I mean, it's not as sort of over the top as it was.
He's not saving the pine weasel.
Yeah, but it's not, he's not the asshole he was at the beginning of Twin Peaks, because the asshole at the beginning of Twin Peaks would have never paid for Miriam's hospital bills. And, like, I like that he's, like, very quietly, even though it feels like you kind of get the sense that he maybe struggles with it sometimes, or struggling with his, like, you know, instincts to, like, you know, to go out with Beverly or something. He is very much trying to be a good person, and I like that.
It does feel like, and you're right, it's easy to forget that because that arc is the pine weasel thing.
Exactly.
If it had been a more down-to-earth thing, like, I don't know, helping, you know, a school or something, like, we'd remember it more.
Yeah.
Not the fucking pine weasel. But I do, yeah, I think they have kept that arc going, and it does feel like this Ben Horn has changed over 25 years, and when he dies one day, he will, like, be remembered as a positive member of the community, not an asshole, you know?
And a great David Letterman impersonator.
Just
right on.
You know, it's very true. Someone noted on Twitter, who also watches Twin Peaks, that it's an interesting thing to trace that some of the characters who were giant assholes in the original Twin Peaks, like Bobby Briggs and Ben Horn, clearly, like, Lynch and Frost have some view of positive self-enhancement, you know?
Sure,
that, like, these characters, we come back 25 years later and they've become better versions of themselves. And that's not true of every character on the show who was there 25 years ago. But there is this sense that people can improve. And I think that fits in with David Lynch's general ethos in that there is a pretty dark cynicism to a lot of Twin Peaks The Return, but I don't think it's monotone. I think there is optimism on many individuals, and I think there is cynicism maybe on a societal level. But that warm humanism is there, and it is represented in the ways some of these people have become better over the years. And I like that.
And that's why you need an episode like this, is because it helps add that tone to the tapestry more and more. And that's why you need, like, the weird asides with the Harry Dean Stanton character to remind you of that, to anchor you in, like, it isn't all bad. It isn't all the atomic bomb. There's a large sort of, like, contrast here between the people who are trying to do what's right and the people who can't.
Yes. So interesting. And of course, this also is a reminder of Richard, which sets us up for something later in the episode that doesn't actually address it. But we'll get there.
Sure.
Anyway.
Well, I mean, because also, I think you have left out, like, at the very end of that Ben Horn speech, he says, like, I love that bike that my father gave me. And that's the last sort of, like, note you leave him on. So he's clearly, like, mulling about, I think probably, like, I read it as he's mulling about his lack of sort of responsibility in Richard Horne's upbringing, and that maybe has contributed to where he went and his own sort of like personal failing. And it also is another little hit of that, of like the larger sort of like argument for Evil Cooper is probably Dick Horne's dad in some manner.
Yes. And just, the sense that, you know, it's not Ben Horne's fault Richard is the way he is, but you understand why he would feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there are two levels there, thinking that, you know, Richard probably never had a father, and then Ben thinking, I should have done something.
Yeah, I should have been a father to him.
And this is why the performance by Richard Boehmer matters, is it's all the things in between the lines that matter. And what I read out of that scene is like, you know, I inside, maybe I knew, but each step of the way, when he was doing like little petty crimes or something, we never stepped in, we never righted the ship, and now it's too late.
Yeah.
You know, and there's this sense, and that's also kind of the arc of the show's view of society in some ways, is like, you know, as things get darker and darker, you never know along the way when it is the right time to step in and do the right thing.
Yeah.
But eventually it might be too late. So yeah. Look, Richard Boehmer's a great actor, and I love that, like everyone who's come back for the show, he's brought it. He's not phoning any of this in.
Yeah.
He's fantastic. So, and Robert Forster in that scene also. Tremendous. Yes. And I love how much warmth the show continues to have for the Harry Truman character. Like, more so than you might expect for, you know, because they have the Truman figure there. They don't have to constantly be doing it. But clearly, like, Michael Aunt Keen is not here because they had any kind of falling out. They love that actor. They love that character. Yeah. And they are constantly paying homage to him. And, you know, wherever Michael Aunt Keen is in the world right now and however he's doing, I hope he sees that. And just that not just the fans, but Lynch and Frost and the show are honoring that character he created, because it really does feel like he is alive in this world, even if we never see Michael Aunt Keen.
Yeah.
And that's a neat magic trick.
Yes.
That most shows couldn't pull off. All right. Let's talk about the second weirdest scene of the episode.
Okay.
Which is Gordon Cole. He's in a couch in the hotel. Got two glasses of wine. He's got a younger woman fawning over him. Interesting little composition I like here. We've got identical lamps on either side. There's a couch between those lamps. There's red curtains behind them. There's a table with two wine glasses. All these, it's a consistent thing actually with Gordon Cole throughout this show, and like that side of the show, the FBI side, is Lynch favors these very painterly like compositions, like very kind of like 17th century, you know, very straight compositions with lots of like clear lines in them and like little pieces of like dualism and things like that. I love all of that. It's just a funny little thing. But Gordon Cole is telling her a story. He says, "The trap was set. They waited till after midnight, and then 75 strong, they came over the mountains. Sirens wailing, guns drawn." And then Albert knocks at the door.
Yeah.
Albert walks in and says, "Gordon, would you please ask your friend to wait downstairs?" He says, "Sweetheart, would you excuse us for a moment? I'll call you in the bar." "Oui, mon chéri." She smiles because, of course, she's French.
Yeah.
And then this scene goes on for like 10 fucking minutes.
This is like one of the most bizarre things that I think David Lynch has ever done. And one of the most inexplicable sequences I've ever seen in anything ever.
Because it goes on and on and on, where she's putting on her shawl and Gordon is smiling at her creepily the whole time. She's like showing off her high heels. She goes, I think actually it's Gordon who goes, "Très chic," has the thumbs up.
Like, you have like that full on like the Graduate shot with the leg in the foreground and David Lynch in the background like smiling.
She's checking her makeup, putting on lipstick. She drinks more wine. Albert seems more and more disgusted by all this. And she drinks the wine and goes, "Très bon." And he goes, Gordon goes, "It's a good one." Which is so funny. She finally stands up and picks up her purse and adjusts her skirt. And then they go over to the door. And Albert just puts his head in his hands at this point. And at the doorway, she slowly like puts a finger on her lips and then traces it over Gordon's lips. And then does this like little pose. And Albert looks like he wants to throw up. And finally she leaves and Cole closes the door. I love how willing David Lynch is to make himself an utter creep.
Yeah, it's a fucking scene, man.
It is so funny. It is so... Partially because, you know, if you had any other actor than David Lynch being the creepy old man, I think it would seem weirdly like... It's more indulgent when it is David Lynch, but it's also like you can forgive it more because he's making himself the butt of the joke.
Yes, yeah.
And that takes a lot of the pressure off of it to me, is that David Lynch himself is so clearly the butt of the joke of the scene, and that he is just kind of pathetic old man in this sequence. And it's fucking hilarious. He's so funny in this.
It's one of those examples of a lot of Lynchian comedy of just like the timing of protracting it and protracting it and it just being very, very slow. And it's very, yes.
And when she's gone, he turns to Albert and says, "She's here visiting a friend of her mother whose daughter has gone missing. The mother owns a turnip farm. I told her to tell the mother that her daughter will turn up eventually. She didn't get it either. Being French, it doesn't translate."
That's like the punchline of the scene is that whole turnip pun. It's unbelievable.
He says, "Do you realize, Albert, that there are over 600 languages spoken on Earth today? Or 6,000 languages?" Yeah. Love it. And Albert just pissed off. And he finally explains that they got that text from Diane that she said they haven't asked yet. And so they think about, what do we know that we haven't asked Diane about yet? And they think about it, and then Gordon finally just says, "We'll figure it out, but for now, I'd really like to get back to this fine Bordeaux." And Albert says, "What kind is it?" And Gordon checks his watch. 11:05. And Albert just looks completely stoic. They have this extremely long stare-off, like minutes long, where it's just back and forth. They are staring. Finally, Cole puts a hand on Albert's shoulder. "Albert, sometimes I really worry about you."
Oh my god.
Comedy duo.
It's so fucking funny.
So fucking funny.
It's like, it's so stupid. It's such a stupid scene. But the comic timing of it is so on point. The turnip pun, the miss, like, and it just like all hinging on at the very end, the misunderstanding from the lack of hearing.
And just,
Jesus Christ.
Just Miguel Ferrer's ability to not crack up in the slightest with David Lynch in his face doing these ridiculous things. I wouldn't be able to do it. Miguel Ferrer's a pro.
Yeah. Just utterly stone-faced throughout the whole scene.
Oh, it's so good. All right. Ugh. Then we have an establishing shot of a little dark house. And in a van, Tim Roth, the assassin hired by Evil Cooper, is polishing a gun. And his weird female cohort, they're joking about maybe torturing the guy, but they're not going to because she's hungry and decide to go to Wendy's. And then the warden, played by Bill Buchanan from 24, comes out of his car. Tim Roth snipes him once, he goes down, but he's not dead, and so he just snipes his head off.
Yeah.
And then the guy's little kid comes out yelling, "Daddy!" And Tim Roth doesn't care. Next stop, Wendy's, and they drive off.
I'm sure Wendy's is thrilled about that promotion.
I know. I'd love for someone to cut that, and like as they drive off, a Wendy's logo comes up.
It's just a Wendy's commercial?
Yeah. No, that is a dark-ass scene, and yet another instance of children being traumatized in this series, which is happening.
I'm just glad he didn't shoot the fucking kid, man. Because he could have, like, there was a moment where I was like, "Oh, God, fucking no, come on, don't fucking shoot the kid, thank you."
But yeah, all right. Well, the warden is dead. He died hard. And that poor kid is scarred for life.
I wouldn't have thought that we would actually have seen that scene. But yeah,
I know. Well, they're very meticulous on this show.
Yeah.
And they have 18 hours to play with. So, all right. Next we cut to, it's 7 o'clock. You know where your freedom is? Coming to you live and electrified. Studio A, high atop the escarpments of Whitetail Peak. The rough, rough, rough of American Hindukush. And that's all I could get.
Yeah.
But we go back to Dr. Jacoby giving one of his speeches, lighting the lamp of freedom, because he has a shitty little lamp of the Statue of Liberty. Nadine is still watching. He has this whole video about the gold shovel.
Yeah.
We all live in the mud, in the shit. Shovel your way out of the shit.
Yes.
Look, there's nothing really new to these scenes anymore, but I still laugh very hard at them.
And it felt weirdly apropos that this was also, if you watched Last Week Tonight, this was the week where they did a segment on Alex Jones.
That's true.
And so, which is obviously what that character is playing off of.
Yeah.
And David Lynch has found a very, like, on-brand way to portray that certain particular kind of, like, crazy charlatan.
What's funny is, you know, I know nothing about Alex Jones other than the little clips I see here and there. And I actually appreciated these scenes more after watching the John Oliver bit, because I didn't know Alex Jones was this huckster selling random supplements and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I recommend that John Oliver segment because I actually think it's a good little piece of journalism. Just like, I think a lot of people don't realize what Alex Jones is actually doing is just selling people shit.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's really what Dr. Jacoby is doing here.
Yes, he's just trying to sell you his fucking shovels that he painted gold so he could upsell them.
Like, it's actually, when you know the whole context with Alex Jones, it's a pretty brilliant piece of satire, which is all he's done is taken a shovel, spray painted it gold, and is now doing this enormous upsell on it.
Yes, just like with this whole stupid frame, like, shovel yourself out of the shit!
Yeah.
It's like he's literally trying to sell people a fucking metaphor, which is not how most sales are supposed to go.
No, but I do. I just love the whole idea that, like, you know, he's distilled the whole Alex Jones phenomenon to its, like, most ridiculous, simple point.
Yeah.
And is doing it here. This whole scene also ends with a great little speech. Fuck you who betray the people you were elected to serve. Fuck you all in the ass, you fucking treasonous puppets. The ninth level of hell will welcome you. And then he starts drooling on himself.
Yeah.
Which is a great ending to the scene.
Yes.
Next. We get the most casual character reintroduction in the history of television.
Yes, another instance of, I feel like David Lynch, the toying you with something and then being like, ha!
Fuck you guys. Hey,
fuck you. You want your stupid fan service? Here you go. This is the fan service you wanted, right?
All
right.
We've all been waiting 12 episodes to meet Audrey Horne again.
Yep.
Sherilyn Fenn. Some of us have been waiting 25 years to see more Sherilyn Fenn in this role. Wait 12 hours, and then just randomly in a scene, she's there. She's standing in front of a fire in a library. She's looking very mad at someone off screen. Camera pans over. This bald guy is sitting behind a messy desk. They're arguing about shit. And what proceeds, I think, is the weirdest scene in Twin Peaks.
Sure. Yeah.
Is that what you were thinking of earlier?
I was actually thinking of the comedy bit with the French woman and it going on for about 12 minutes.
Oh, no. This is weirder.
Okay.
And I'll explain to you why I think it's weirder. Because this scene is ludicrously long.
Yes.
It's like the last 15 minutes of the episodes. After the episode, it's just two people talking. One of them we know, but we don't know anything about her in the intervening 25 years. And they are talking exclusively about a series of characters we have never heard about before. And it's just this long, long conversation about Billy and Tina and Chuck and these relationships. And we know nothing about any of it. At some point we realize Billy must be the guy whose truck was stolen and hit the boy, like with Richard. But that's it in terms of what we get. It's extremely long, and it's just a simple shot reverse shot on these two. A couple of times they're in the same frame when you were shot over Audrey's shoulder. But that's it. It is all oddity and duration. And there's this extremely long part at the end where the husband character finally decides he's going to call Tina to try to figure this out. And you hear this entire... In most TV shows, they do this elision with phone calls, right?
Yeah.
Where the actual act of watching the person on the other side of the phone, they cut that down. No, he'll just be waiting there for like 30 seconds and Audrey will be watching him. And then he'll say something ominous. And something ominous is happening. And then at the end of the scene, Audrey is just incredulous and she says, "Really? You're not going to tell me what she said?" And she screams it again, channeling part of the audience, I think. And then we cut away from it because of course we fucking cut away from it. This is opaque... This is an opaque kick to the balls of a scene.
Sure, yeah.
And when I was saying this episode could be hugely alienating to people, this is the one I was thinking of because Audrey is not one of those characters who has become a better person in the intervening years. She is a bitter shell of herself.
Yeah.
We know, like, we don't get any of the stuff we expected to see, like, maybe about, like, she's talking about where did this guy go? And we're thinking maybe she's looking for Richard. Nope, we don't learn about any of that. We don't really get any of the classic Audrey stuff. It is completely toying with the audience, and I think in the end I found it fascinating in an experimental way, but I can completely understand someone watching this scene flipping the TV off and never watching Twin Peaks again.
Sure, although I think like the scene that follows, which is the last scene where they're where you are with a group of characters we have no idea who they are, like those kids, like the teenagers or whatever, sitting in the bar talking about like some other series of events that we have no insight into, like that scene... Putting them basically, I don't know if they were literally back-to-back, but like basically...
Almost.
Yeah, like having both of those sort of at the end of the episode, I feel like having that last scene puts into context for me this scene with Audrey of... I think it's like they're kind of doing the same thing, but you have different expectations in the Audrey one because we know who Audrey is when we don't... We shouldn't necessarily have different expectations. That we're still getting the same kind of information. We're still getting the same kind of tone. We're still getting the same sense of like... relationships devolving and like the world falling apart in both those scenes, and you don't necessarily have more insight just because it's Audrey Horne.
I agree completely. I think there's a lot of value and interesting things going on in both of these scenes. I also think, like, when we talk about Lynch, like, playing with people...
Oh, he's definitely doing that, yeah.
Harder than at any other point in The Return, because it's like... I mean, you could argue with the Dougie stuff, but the
I would argue with the Dougie stuff is the hardest.
The Dougie stuff also has its own mini layers of internal substance and, like, entertaining things going on. This is, like... This is a challenging, like, confrontationally challenging scene in terms of its duration.
Sure, yeah.
In terms of just how opaque it is. In terms of, like... all right, Dougie is not Dale Cooper. Dougie still exists on the same tonal wavelength as Agent Cooper in terms of the kind of warmth and humor going on there.
Sure.
This is not anything you would expect out of Audrey Horne, even if, honestly, that's probably where she would end up 25 years later, knowing everything that happened to Audrey on the original series and apparently afterwards. So, like, yeah, I think there's value to it. I just can also imagine, like, as I said, if somehow you made it this far and were still anywhere on the fence, this might have topped you over.
Yeah. But I think there's a lot
tipped
of...
Tipped you over.
Sure.
Yeah, lost the word.
I'll let you sort of fuck yourself over the English language over there. But I think there's something really interesting with the Audrey thing. You pointed out earlier that at the beginning of the scene, they're talking about, like, you're not going to help me find him. And it's just, like, him for a while. And so I think naturally any viewer would assume they must be talking about Dick Horne, because we had that earlier scene with Ben, and sort of establishing that within this episode, that's a thing that is going on. And so normally when you're plotting something, that would have set up the expectation that when you then meet Audrey Horne at the end of the episode, it would be following up on that series of events. And he, you know, the writing and everything frames it that you assume it's going to be that until it sort of like takes the rug out from under you. And it's like, it's some guy named Billy that Audrey, I guess, is having an affair with. And that's like, that's the actual relationship, which to me, that's actually like the almost like hits way harder when you realize she has no idea. She doesn't know that Richard has murdered someone. She has no idea. She's so not a part of his life.
I agree.
That she's not even in that storyline at all. She's in her own crazy soap opera where she's getting divorced with this guy and is sleeping with this other person. And there's some lady named Tina that's sort of like an in between with all of them. They're on their own fucking TV show and you're not a part of it.
I agree. I think this is a really interesting experiment of a scene in challenging your expectations and your patience, you know? Because, yeah, I mean, when you actually think about it, Audrey, we've been assuming things about Audrey. She has not been named at all in the show other than the mention that she was in a coma at one point.
Yeah.
But, like, in all the scenes with Ben Horne, never mentioned. And we know Ben loves his daughter. That's, like, the one thing you knew about Ben consistently from the original series, right? And, you know, she has not been named in the scenes where we went to the Horne household and all those terrible things happened. She has not been named in all the stuff with the investigation when they know Richard. It's like, I think, you know, Audrey is way out of the loop on all this, and everyone in Twin Peaks knows damn well.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. If that were our only scene with Sherilyn Fenn in The Return, it would not fucking surprise me.
Right, yeah.
I don't think it would be able to
say what it needed to say if that was the case.
Yeah, like, it's an interesting scene. And, you know, the scene is so consumed with things we have so little context for that at a certain point I was writing a lot of this down and realizing I was getting none of it, because it's like listening to a foreign language. Like, I know English and I know these words, but like, it's so about all these people I've never heard of and this relationship we have no context for, and this relationship, frankly, between Audrey and her weird husband Charlie that makes no sense. Like, I guess they married for money, but now they're openly cheating on each other, and maybe there's a divorce going on, but no one seems all that invested in it. Like, it's so fucking bizarre that, like, at some point you just have to sit back and let it kind of wash over you and realize it kind of feels like those scenes in Inland Empire where it's in Polish, and if you're watching it on a torrent, there's no subtitles, and you just kind of have to go with it.
Sure.
But frankly, those scenes made more sense to me.
So, or I think, like, maybe the more apt comparison is, like, if you tune into episode 578 of some random fucking telenovela.
That's true.
And, like, everyone's talking about, like, this person has cheated on this person, and this person is, like, missing, and like, oh, I guess you're getting divorced, I don't know, and you don't know who anybody is, and it's just, like, this scene dense with dialogue about characters you don't know who they are. It feels like that.
I agree, because new Twin Peaks mostly has not done the soap opera stuff that old Twin Peaks was very consciously playing with, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's mostly abandoned that. But then we cut here, and this feels like if the soap opera that was Twin Peaks was on the air 5 days a week for 25 years, this is where we would be now.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it feels like, and because of that, it feels like a very curdled, brutal version of Twin Peaks, the soap opera. But it does feel like, we just missed the 25 intervening years of Mysteries of Love or something.
Yeah.
Which was the show within a show in season one.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But there is one scene between this and the Roadhouse scene, and that is a scene with Diane in the hotel bar where she puts in the coordinates that she remembers, and we find it's Twin Peaks as we predicted.
Yes.
So, interesting scene, but we kind of knew that was coming.
I was kind of hoping, I was really hoping that as she zoomed in, it would be some town you've never heard of.
Yeah.
It's just like some random, like, Hoduck town that's a different town in the Northwest. It's like, okay, the cutaway.
No.
David Lynch is not that cruel to do that.
I mean, clearly this is a story about how all roads are going to lead back to Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
All right. We do go back to the Roadhouse. We've got a band playing under purple lights at a booth. Two women are having Heinekens, which if you've seen Blue Velvet, you'll know is Jeffrey Beaumont's beer of choice.
Exactly, yeah.
The two women are talking about Clark, Mary, and Angela, and this weird love triangle. And as you say, it really is like this totally random interstitial, and we have just as much context for it as the Audrey scene. But weirdly, this one feels less confusing because we don't go in with those expectations.
You just accept it as you having no background information about these people at all. So you're starting from nothing. And so you don't have any assumptions that you're making. So you just are able to naturally figure out what the conversation is about.
Exactly. So this is interesting because we've had several of these random interstitials at the Roadhouse.
Yeah.
And my guess is these are just meant to kind of be little vignettes about weird slices of life in Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's about sort of the pervasive darkness, like the woman who was scratching that itch on her arm and it was really gross and horrific. Like that's like felt like it was part of this overall sense of darkness pervading things. And this one feels like it's a, as you say, it's a sister scene to the Audrey thing and a little bit of commentary on the episode. And in, you know, one of those scenes earlier on is where we kind of met Richard and his brutality. So like these scenes do not feel like they're ever, I don't think we're going to meet these characters again. I don't think they're about anything bigger, but they are just these little slices of life.
Yeah, and it's like the main insight we get into like younger characters on the show because most of the characters we interact with are older people. You know, it's like Cooper or it's like Gordon Cole and stuff. It's like people that are 40, 50, 60 years old for the most part.
Yeah.
Whereas like original Twin Peaks, the cast was basically split between adult characters and young characters. And we don't have any, like, we have a couple of, like, sort of younger characters that are more in the show regularly, like a Richard Horn. But by and large, the insight we get into, like, the youth culture of Twin Peaks is through these tiny little windows at the Roadhouse we get every now and then. And there's a sense of just how much time has changed this town since the early 90s.
Yeah. And then we go out on another musical performance, which I liked once again.
Yeah.
Really nice way to end these episodes. Remember in the premiere when that ended with Shelley seeing James there?
Yeah, we still have not seen James. I think about that every single episode. I think it's like, are we ever going to see James again?
I'm kind of guessing no at this point because that actually was a really nice little scene for James, even though he said nothing. Yeah. I don't know. But there was also that little hint that he'd had an accident at some point, so who knows. But because of where it was placed in one of those Roadhouse scenes that really never come up again, I kind of feel like maybe that's it for James.
Yeah.
But who knows? We'll see. Twin Peaks is Twin Peaks.
It is. Who knows? Like, maybe James is going to be there at the, like, the random place of, like, the confluence of hell portals and everything.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, I'm James. Like, I had the accident, and that gave me insight into an alternate dimension, and now I'm going to take over the world, and you must defeat me because I'm God. That's how it ends.
I've said, as I said about Game of Thrones, Twin Peaks could end with a fight with a hell demon. Who knows?
Yes. And his name might just be James.
All right. So we've only got 6 episodes left of Twin Peaks over 5 weeks.
Yeah.
We're coming up on the end, but I'm so excited to see where it goes.
Yes.
All right.
I would say what my predictions are going to be for next week, but who fucking knows?
Yes.
Who would have ever predicted this episode? Anything in this episode.
All right. Subscribe to our Patreon if you would like.
Yes.
Patreon.com/weeklystuffpodcast. Have a look out for those Let's Plays coming this Friday. They're really good, and I hope you enjoy them.
Yeah.
We're going to also subscribe to our YouTube channel. YouTube, the channel is just the Weekly Stuff Podcast, so you can find that, and I've tweeted it out and whatnot. And we're going to have that Doctor Who thing coming at some point. So lots of exciting stuff happening. And we will see you guys back here next Wednesday for more Twin Peaks and talk about the video game Tacoma and so much more.
We must defeat James. It's the only way out.